exception. They're for something different.
So, on More or Less, we unpack those figures that crop up in our lives, peeling back the data to get to the real insights. The new series of More or Less with me, Tim Harford, Wednesday mornings at 9. To listen on your smart speaker, just say play Radio 4.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Saturday the 16th of May. This is Vigialis. Good morning. Thousands of police will be on the streets of London today to manage two large protests, which Scotland Yard says could lead to one of its busiest days in years. There will be what's called a sterile zone managed by officers between one march organised by the far-right figure Tommy Robinson and a pro-Palestinian demonstration. Tom Simons reports.
Tommy Robinson's called for a demonstration to unite the kingdom. Last year, around 150,000 turned out to a similar event. The Palestine Solidarity Campaign will commemorate the dispossession of Palestinians in 1948 and oppose Robinson's march. Police will deploy a facial recognition unit, drones, helicopters and temporary lamppost-mounted cameras to monitor the crowds. With two anti-Semitic terror attacks in less than a year, prosecutors have advised police to step in and deal with chants and slogans which may breach hate crime law.
Labour has begun the process of choosing a candidate for the Macclesfield by-election, which may decide Sir Keir Starmer's future. Andy Burnham, the Mayor of Greater Manchester, has been cleared to put his name forward by the party's ruling National Executive Committee, and he's expected to challenge Sir Keir for the Labour leadership if he wins. On Any Questions last night, the Home Office Minister, Mike Tapp, who backs the Prime Minister, apologised for the past week of speculation.
From my heart, absolutely apologise to the public and to everybody in this room today and every listener for what you're seeing. This isn't what I was elected to do. Seeing what's unfolded in front of us over the last few weeks has been really, really painful for me.
President Trump has warned Taiwan against formally declaring independence from China, saying he talked for a whole night about the issue with President Xi during his visit. Asked by Fox News whether the people of Taiwan should feel more or less secure after his visit to Beijing, Mr. Trump replied, neutral. He said he hadn't decided whether to go ahead with a major weapons sale to Taiwan. Israel says it has targeted the leader of Hamas's military wing in Gaza, who it said was one of the main planners of the October the 7th attacks in 2023. A senior security official said indications suggested Izzat Din al-Haddad had been killed, but Hamas has not commented on the reports. From Jerusalem, Emir Nader reports.
Izzat-Din al-Haddad has been the de facto leader of Hamas in Gaza for almost a year. If the assassination attempt was successful, Israel would have killed the last remaining mastermind of the October the 7th attacks. Eyewitnesses told the BBC that an apartment in Gaza City was struck by multiple missiles, and survivors who escaped by car were targeted in subsequent strikes. Israeli military officials accused Haddad of responsibility for the murder, kidnap and injury of Israeli citizens and troops, and of violating the current ceasefire by working to rebuild Hamas capabilities. Hamas spokespeople have accused Israel of consistently violating the ceasefire since it came into effect last October.
Lebanon has accused Israel of deliberately targeting medical facilities, even as the two countries agreed to extend their ceasefire for another 45 days. The health ministry said three paramedics were among six people killed when an emergency response center in the south of the country was hit. Israel has previously denied targeting medics and says it's hitting sites linked to the Iranian-backed group Hezbollah. Police Scotland say a 19-year-old man has been charged with a data protection offence after the personal details of a football referee were leaked online. The Scottish FA says John Beaton and his family were under police surveillance after their private information became public. Mr. Beaton awarded a controversial penalty on Wednesday, which meant Celtic kept alive their chances of winning the league title today when they face Hearts. Time for the weather now. Here's Elizabeth Rizzini.
Thank you, Vigi. Well, it's all about to turn a lot warmer as we head into next week. But until then, plenty of showers, longer spells of rain at times. It's quite a mixed day today. It's a chilly start to the morning across Scotland and northern England. But there is a front moving in from the west. So already cloudier with some outbreaks of patchy rain across Northern Ireland, southwest England and Wales. And of course, underneath the cloud, it's a milder start here. Further east for much of Scotland and England, it's bright and it's chilly. The bright skies, the sunshine will last longest across parts of East Anglia and eastern Scotland well into the afternoon. But the cloud in the west will be pushing further eastwards. And by the time we get to the middle of the afternoon, it'll be cloudy for most parts of the UK, with, again, some outbreaks of mostly light patchy rain and drizzle. Sunshine and showers developing for Northern Ireland behind that main front. Light to moderate westerly to southwesterly winds, but you won't notice a massive jump in temperature today. Generally between 11 and 13 Celsius in the north and 13 and 15 degrees Celsius further south.
Elizabeth Rizzini at the BBC Weather Centre. And now for a look at the morning papers. Supporters of Andy Burnham have told The Guardian that the Greater Manchester Mayor will push to become Labour's leader by the autumn so that he can address its September conference as Prime Minister. The paper reports that allies of Mr. Burnham believe he can win a leadership election before the summer recess. The Daily Telegraph claims loyalists who support the Prime Minister believe Sir Keir Starmer could resign if Mr. Burnham wins the Macclesfield by-election and is the only leadership challenger. The paper says Sir Keir is much less defiant in private than in public. The Eye paper suggests Andy Burnham would play down his support for closer European integration if he became Prime Minister to avoid alienating Reform UK voters. And Reform's leader Nigel Farage warns the Daily Express readers that if the Greater Manchester Mayor believes he can use local people to waltz in as leader, the by-election will give him a very nasty shock. The Daily Mail says financial markets are worried Mr. Burnham would bankrupt Britain, while The Sun's editorial laments that Britain is doomed to a summer of uncertainty and economic stagnation. The Times says the Prime Minister, fighting for his political life, is preparing to agree an £18 billion increase to defence spending. Senior civil servants and ministers have warned the Financial Times that parts of the government are at risk of paralysis as any forthcoming leadership battle would overtake a policy agenda. We will have months where the business of daily government will have to grind to a halt, one unnamed cabinet minister tells the paper. The Mirror is one of several papers to revel in the news that Sir David Beckham is Britain's first billionaire sportsman after he and his wife, Lady Victoria, doubled their fortune in the last year. Dosh and Becks is the headline. The Star says the Beckhams, whose home was once labelled Beckingham Palace, now place ahead of King Charles on the list. And that's a look at this morning's papers. This is BBC Radio 4, now on Open Country. Kaz Graham is in Cumbria to see Donald Campbell's hydroplane Bluebird K7 return to Coniston.
Oh, God. He's blown up. She's run cartwheeling over and over. What a terrible disaster.
He just took off as far as I could see and turned over backward.
Did a complete somersault and dived back into the water just short of the end of the kilometre.
And then sank?
As far as I could see, sank immediately.
Anyone who saw the news broadcast back in January 1967 will remember that fateful moment when Donald Campbell tragically died while trying to set the world water speed record on Coniston Water here in Cumbria. I'm standing on the pier, the very pier that Bluebird K7, Campbell's iconic hydroplane, launched from that morning, to see, almost 60 years later, her return to the water. Visitors from around the UK and across the world are all flocking here, hoping to catch a glimpse of Donald Campbell's striking bright blue boat powering down this lake again during a week-long Bluebird Festival. Well, with me down here by the lake on a beautiful spring morning. We've got Wetherlam and Conas Knoll Man practically glinting, shining in the sun behind us. And with me is Anthony Robbie Robinson, who was part of Donald Campbell's team back in 1967. I mean, in fact, the Campbells actually stayed at your family's hotel, pub, and Donald was your pal, wasn't he?
Yes, I knew Donald very well. I first of all knew him as a small boy, when I had to call him Mr. Campbell. And, of course, back in 1966-67, we all knew him as the skipper.
Tell us a little about where we are and why this is so significant.
We stood on the end of this pier beside the slipway, which is just behind us, where we used to launch Bluebird, so she could actually literally be started up here out beside the pier, providing we've got everybody out of the way behind her.
Why did you need to get everybody out of the way?
It was a dangerous business. If you were really right behind the jet pipe, it was like walking into a solid wall. You had to be well clear. But that meant that Donald could actually taxi, if you like, sort of taxi out into the middle of the lake where we're looking out now, which is about, sort of, about, I suppose, half a mile wide here, and set off from there.
And we have been on this pier with you before, haven't we? Because back in 2010, Open Country came to Coniston after Bluebird had been, well, raised from the depths of these waters. Here we are, 16 years later, Bluebird is going to be back on the water. What do you make of that?
Yes, it's great that the Campbell legend is still being kept going. I think it's absolutely wonderful.
Why did he want to keep going back, to break his own record?
Well, he was very patriotic, and he was determined the Americans would never recapture it, not in his lifetime anyway.
Take us back to that day in January 1967. I mean, I know you'll have recounted this story hundreds of times, but would you just talk us through what happened?
I came down that morning and I met Donald coming the other way or something. And, you know, I said, "Good morning, skipper, how are you doing? You all right?" Yes. And he would say, "Yep, yep, yep. Are you nearly ready?" Yes, I'm just waiting for Leo.
And Leo was his right-hand man, wasn't he?
Sorry, Leo Villa, who was Donald's head mechanic, yes. At that stage, we'd left our safety boats moored on the lake because we didn't want to disturb the water. So we used to drive around the east side of the lake and then just paddle out in a little rubber dinghy. We could then hear the engine accelerating and we could see Bluebird spray going up as she came up onto her planing surfaces, and then she was away and she was coming towards us. And of course, at 300 miles an hour, it doesn't take long. And she came past us looking really good, really solid on the water. And the timekeepers sent Donald a message, which was sort of slightly coded but quite obvious, that the average speed for the south run was 297 miles an hour. And the next thing was we saw him turn round and start his return run. And again, looked okay. Until he is approaching the beginning of the kilometre, and all of a sudden the front of the boat began to rise and it did this complete loop in the air, crashed back into the water, and I was just there sort of, you know, open mouthed, and Leo had to slap me on the back and say, "Come on, Robbie, for Christ's sake, get going. We need to get out there and get him." Unfortunately, when we got out there, the Bluebird had sunk. All that was left on the surface was a load of little plastic bags which had been part of the buoyancy system for Bluebird. We found Donald's shoes and his socks and his gloves, his life jacket, and we also picked up his little mascot, Mr. Woppet. Mr. Woppet, of course, is still in the possession of Donald's daughter, Gina.
He's a little teddy.
So he survived. The next thing was Leo was saying, "Well, where can we get some divers? If he's down there, he may be stuck in the thing. He's got 30 minutes air," because he had an air supply. But of course, eventually, as time went on, Donald didn't appear. And after about, I suppose, an hour, everybody was wanting to talk to Leo back here at the base. So he transferred to another boat. And Leo said, "Robbie, will you stay on the lake and just keep here where he went down in case he comes up?" So I spent the next 3 hours just cruising around.
On my own, which was
a bit eerie. After about midday, I thought if he was going to come up, he would have come up by now, or if his body was going to come up, it would have come up. So I made a decision to come home on my own. I locked all the little bits and pieces that we pulled out of the lake, like his shoes and socks and things. I put them in out of sight in a little cubbyhole, and I went home. My mum was very upset. Sorry.
I bet she was. And you're upset as well.
Well, it's just remembering. It brings these memories back, actually, yeah. I keep saying I can manage. And it took me years. I didn't realise this, but I used to think, well, maybe he did survive the accident, which was absolutely ridiculous. But many years later, I was talking to a man who was writing a book on Donald, and he said that's quite normal. He said people like that. He said their mind doesn't accept what their eyes have seen.
And your eyes were so close to what happened as well. You were how far were you away from the crash?
A couple of hundred metres.
Yeah.
Probably.
So close.
Until I saw Bluebird after she was brought up and actually looked at the devastation of the front part of that boat, I had no idea just what must have happened to Donald. And of course, shortly afterwards, his body was recovered, which was a good thing in his view, that at least his family, and particularly Gina, I think, had somewhere where she could go and sort of, you know, have a quiet few minutes and grieve a little bit.
That's Gina, his daughter.
Yes.
Well, she was recovered in 2001, along with Donald's body as well, just shortly afterwards. Mm. She has since then been fully restored. She came back to the village, which must have been a momentous occasion, in 2024. What was it like seeing her again? That bright blue, the Union Jack on the tail fin.
Well, it was... yes, it was a little bit... lump in the throat time again, to be honest. And then to see her back in Coniston and just to be able to touch her was sends a shiver down your spine. Still does.
Yeah. And what's it going to be like when you see her on this water, back on the lake, where I guess, well, it's a spiritual home, isn't it?
It definitely is. And it will be goose pimple time, I'm sure it will be. Possibly, you know, a few tears, maybe. But I'm still looking forward immensely to seeing Bluebird back in her element and doing what she was built to do and what she did best.
Oh, that is the sound of the engine of K7 being fired up. They're just going through some tests before she hits the water tomorrow. And you can tell just how much Donald Campbell and Bluebird mean to Coniston by the names of lots of things around here. I enjoyed a pint of Bluebird Bitter last night. I've just made my way along past the Bluebird Cafe to meet Tracy Hodgson from the Ruskin Museum. That's where the restored Bluebird normally lives. And Tracy is the woman who has had the mammoth job of pulling this week-long festival together. At the museum, you've got an entire wing devoted to Bluebird, haven't you?
We have. We've got items in there that obviously relate to Malcolm as well, which was Donald's dad. But primarily around Donald and K7.
And how much interest is there still in this story? Because it all happened a long time ago.
It did, yes. The interest has been renewed since she came back in 2024. In that year that she came back, we had 63,000 visitors through the doors at the museum.
I mean, how many people live in Coniston?
Oh, a couple of thousand.
Yeah. Goodness me. I mean, people here have always been quite protective about Donald and the Campbell family, haven't they?
Yeah.
How do people feel about a week-long festival?
I think most people are really happy that we're doing it. We're paying tribute to Donald. So 2026 is the 70th anniversary of his first record. So that's the reason we're doing it this year.
Okay, tell us what's going to happen.
The plan is to put her on the water and run her at speed.
When you say at speed, what speed are you talking about?
So we've got a speed exemption with a maximum of up to 150 mile an hour, but she'll play in around about 60, 70 miles an hour.
150 miles an hour, that's kind of like almost unimaginably fast, really.
Yeah, well, I mean, Donald was attempting 300 when he was tragically killed, so it's, you know, it's well within its capabilities.
I mean, it's so interesting, isn't it? Because it was a different age, wasn't it, when Donald Campbell made these attempts on the lake? You know, it was before the moon landings.
It was.
It was the age of daring do and trying to be the highest, the furthest, exploring, all that kind of thing. How did people perceive what he was doing at the time?
A lot of people, that, you know, that he was their childhood hero. And, you know, what he was doing was revolutionary. He was, nobody else was doing it.
And do you think he became the legend that he is because of the way that he died?
Yes. Yes.
Because we know that his dad also set loads of records.
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, the way he was killed, that sort of enhanced the story a bit, I think.
And the Campbells had such close ties to Coniston as well.
They did.
How important is this story for the village and for tourism in the village? Get people coming to this village?
Yeah. Coniston villagers class Donald as their adopted son. He was here quite a lot of the time, obviously, trying to break records, waiting for the late conditions. It means a lot to the village, and I think it'll be very good, you know, financially for the village. You know, hopefully it'll put Coniston on the map.
Obviously, conditions have to be absolutely right for Bluebird to go out onto that water. You've got to make sure everything's perfectly safe. What needs to happen, say, weather-wise and water-wise?
Obviously, the lake has to be fairly calm. If it's too choppy or you get a side wind, you know, obviously they're not the conditions you want to be running in. You know, we're checking throughout the day, and when we get the okay from the water safety team, you know, we'll be doing it.
Where is Bluebird now?
So she's just behind us in the marquee, just behind us.
Can we go and see her?
You can, yeah.
Oh my goodness. She's so blue. I mean, I know that's a daft thing to say, but she is so blue, isn't she? Bright blue.
It's a beautiful colour, isn't it?
Yeah. Dave Warby, you are going to be piloting this. What do you call it? Do you call her a boat? Do you call her a hydroplane?
Yeah, it's a boat in my world.
It's a boat in your world.
Yeah, yeah. So we're used to jet hydroplanes with engines, aircraft engines in them.
She's an extraordinary looking vessel, isn't she? I mean, if I had to pick something out, I'd say she looks like something out of Thunderbirds.
It does, and you think it was built in 1955, and it's quite high tech for 1955. It's virtually an aircraft on water.
Yeah. Talk me through her, because she's got this almost like a capsule in the middle, and then on each side, these kind of wings almost.
Yeah, they call them sponsons, so that's what the boat lifts out of the water and rides on. So you've got the centre section with the cockpit and the engine in the back behind it, and then you've got the sponsons on it either side, so it lifts up on top of the water and rides on them.
It's so interesting, because when you see the film of Donald Campbell in Bluebird, it looks like she's not even on the water.
No.
It just looks like she's floating above
it
at those ridiculous speeds.
Yeah.
How similar is this boat now to the boat that Campbell drove? Because she has been restored painstakingly by the Bluebird Project over in the northeast, hasn't she?
Yeah, they have. They've restored Bluebird. You know, the original sponsons of the boat are different. Every part that can be replaced, you know, the guys up there have replaced. Most of it couldn't be recovered. So, yeah, they've done a good job.
Wow. And so, look, let's walk over a bit around here if we may. What is going on at the moment? We've got somebody sitting in the cockpit, haven't we?
Yeah, looking at the air system, just because we've got an air system on the boat for the cockpit from a helmet and radio and stuff like that. So,
what, so you're getting oxygen while you're in there?
No.
When you say an air system?
An air system. So it's if the boat goes underwater or anything like that, I've got breathing air. So if the mast gets wet, the air, it clicks over to the air.
Wow.
So, and it's got a radio comm system, so we're just going through the basic stuff on it.
There's a woman sitting in the cockpit at the moment, and I mean, you look like a pilot. You look like a First World War pilot. And she's got the Union Jacks on the front as well. And right on the end of the nose piece, a little yellow circle with a Bluebird. That's phenomenal, isn't it? What's it going to be like for you piloting this boat?
I've got a job to do, so I'll be very much focused on driving the boat and ensuring that it's operated safely and brought back safely, because it needs to go in a museum. But I've known about Bluebird since I was a kid, so I knew about record breaking long before I knew who the Australian cricket players and football players were, because I was brought up with it. It's an iconic piece of history, and it's a tremendous honour to be able to drive it.
Because your dad, he's a water speed record holder
as well. He holds the current world water speed record.
Yeah, I mean, sadly you lost him a wee while ago.
Yeah.
And for you to be sitting in Donald Campbell's boat, that must be extraordinary.
Well, Donald Campbell inspired my father to break the world water speed record, because he was in Australia doing the land speed and water speed records, so that inspired my father to go for it. And during my father's attempt, he was in correspondence with Leo Villa, the guy who wind-tunnelled this boat, Bluebird, also wind-tunnelled my father's boat, Professor Tom Fink. So there's been a connection there for a little while, so it's really good to be able to driving the boat that inspired my father.
Have you sat in that cockpit?
Yeah.
How is it?
Beautiful. looking forward to tomorrow.
Does it put a shiver up your spine?
Yeah, it does, actually. I went out to the crash site on a couple of days ago. Yeah, it was a spiritual thing to go out there and be at the location and where the accident happened. But I think it's a lot more than the accident. People have got to think about what this boat done and what it inspired. And I think it's good this day and age to have that.
How did it come about that you are going to be piloting?
Well, I've been running a jet boat for a few years now, and it's got an Orpheus engine in it. So I got experience driving the jet hydroplane, sorting it out. So the museum invited me to drive it, so I took them up on it.
So have you had a chance to practice yet?
No. Be tomorrow. We're not just going to go out and go 150 mile an hour. We're just going to feel the boat out and sort it out. So driving a boat is very much by feel. How you feel in the boat determines how you drive it.
And how different is this boat to the contemporary boats that you have now?
Really not much different. The design of the boat, my boat holds a lot more air under it, but it's how you manage the air. This one doesn't really trap air underneath it. So it's the same design. Mine's a hydroplane, this is a hydroplane. It's just that how the hull works and operates is a little bit different.
You know, some people listening to this, Dave, might be saying, blimey, it's just a gas-guzzling bit of metal, isn't it? A noisy antique out on the lake. What would you say to them?
It's a noisy antique that's got a lot of history behind it, and I think in this day and age people should reflect on what a British boat like Bluebird and other record breakers have done in the past, because, you know, it's getting off your rear end and having a go like this that makes countries great. My father is the first person in history to build, design and drive a boat to a world water speed record. And we had the world knocking him for it and saying he'd never do it. And to take on the world and still hold the world record, break two world records, that's the reason I'm doing what I'm doing. You see the adversity that your parents and my father goes through, and to take on the world and be the best.
Some people will not understand wanting to go fast.
As far as I'm concerned, and my father as well, it's not about the speed, it's about the engineering. Driving is just a component of it. It's about solving the problems and sorting the boat out and building the better mousetrap. You become part of the boat. And if you can do that and concentrate on the boat, you'll sort the boat out better and achieve your goal.
And with this boat here, with Bluebird, how important is this lake, this location, Coniston Water, to this boat?
Oh, it's probably the most iconic venue for record breaking in the world. Sadly, it's remembered for the accident, but I think it's important to remember what was achieved here as well.
And when you're here, when you look up to the hills around Old Manor Coniston, you know, the fantastic green of the woodland around here, what does that do for you?
Well, I want to move over here. It's beautiful. it's really good. And I've got to say, just full credit to the community and people involved here. And, you can have the best boat and the best driver, but if you don't have that community support and the people behind it, you're not going anywhere.
Well, today is the day. It's dawn, bright, fresh, just a little bit breezy, and the ducks and swans and geese here on the beach at Coniston Water are probably slightly bemused by the hundreds of people who are still arriving. The lake is really busy. We've got some bright yellow powerboat rescue launches, ribs in front of us, loads of boats knocking around, lots and lots of people, lots happening, and we're all here waiting to see Bluebird back on the lake with Dave Warby in the cockpit, 70 years after Donald Campbell set his first world water speed record here. Tell me, why are you here?
I'm here simply because of basically my mum's memories.
It's really exciting, isn't it? There's a right buzz in the air about it.
Oh, absolutely, and I'm sure people have got all their own memories, and it's just something that you can't miss.
It's local history, it's our history.
Local history,
local to
our Cumbria, history.
It's our hero. We've got to look after our history, because if we don't bring it on to the younger generation, it'll just get forgotten.
But I'm so pleased for Donald's daughter. She fought to get it brought back here, and Bluebird is in its rightful home, and it's absolutely wonderful. I just hope and pray we see it on the water today. I really do.
I mean, there's a lot of jeopardy in it, and it's like a magnetic attraction, to actually come and see such a fantastic machine running on the water, So it's really mind-blowing that they can actually go at such a fantastic speed, really.
Why have you come here today? What's brought you here?
to see this wonderful vessel that I know personally.
How come?
I worked for a short time for Donald.
What do you think he'd have made of the fact that there are hundreds of people here on the lake shore today to see Bluebird on the water again?
I'm sure he'd have been very proud of that. He was very patriotic. He believed in Britain, so hopefully this will bring back the spirit of adventure.
I've seen it, I've seen the footage, I've seen everything, seen footage of it when it was retrieved, and like, but then we're going to hear it.
Right at the very front of the crowd, down by the water, as she should be, is Gina Campbell, Donald Campbell's daughter.
Yes, the only child. It all finishes with me, I'm afraid, because I have no children. It's unbelievable, the amount of people. I cannot believe the amount of people. And the age, the young people, that's what's so inspiring, is that it's young people as well as older people. And I brought my dad's teddy bear, Mr. Woppet, and he's going in the boat.
Really?
And my father was always very, very superstitious, and he had little mascots and little rituals and things, and he was presented with Mr. Woppet as his mascot. And really, my father was a very mixture of people. He was extremely sentimental and very soft, and he just took a shine to Mr. Woppet. And he went everywhere with him.
Do you know what's it like seeing Bluebird here on the slipway?
Do you know the last time I saw her? I was a little girl, and I was swimming in the lake with my dad breaking a record. And I was swimming. It's the last time I remember being here with my father.
And here she is, shining in the sunshine now.
It is amazing.
What would your dad have made of this?
I think he would be blown away, completely blown away. The work that has gone into this boat and the trials and tribulations to get her here today is just... I just take my hat off to everybody, everybody that's made today happen. Yeah, it's going to be a very emotional day.
By some sight, there she is, floating on Coniston water, surrounded by hundreds of people, the flags of all the little boats around her, the ducks bobbing around, back on Coniston, where she belongs for the first time in nearly 60 years.
That was Kazagram in Cumbria for Open Country. The programme was produced by Helen Leonard.
The 8th of August, 1963. A gang of thieves hold up a British Royal Mail train on its way from Glasgow to London. More than £2 million was stolen, and Ronnie Biggs was the most famous face of the great train robbery.
Daniel Mays reveals the true story of Ronnie Biggs.
A train robbery, a prison escape, and 36 years on the run.
Gangster presents the story of Ronnie Biggs.
Listen first on BBC Sounds.
Now on Radio 4, Farming Today this week with Anna Hill.
Good morning. This week, too many pigs, not enough space, farmers struggling to sell their livestock.
Some people that are worst affected are starting to burst at the seams.
New strategies for tackling the spread of animal disease. We ask, how much is being done to stop it getting here in the first place?
Managing illegal imports continues to be really important.
And prize-winning sheep at the Balmoral Show in Northern Ireland.
We didn't think she'd be able to do it because she had two bad legs as a lamb, and then she was winning her class. It was very unexpected.
We'll have more from there a little bit later. Let's start with chickens, eggs and cages. In the UK, egg-laying chickens are allowed to be kept in so-called enriched colony cages. The old battery cages were banned back in 2012. Well, now vets organisations are calling for a ban on imports of eggs produced by caged hens and a phasing out of the legal enriched colony cages here in the UK. The British Veterinary Association and British Veterinary Poultry Association are supporting the government's plan to end the use of enriched cage systems here. The Junior Vice President of the British Veterinary Association, Gwen Rees, told me that they want an enriched colony cage ban to be accompanied by an import ban so UK farmers improve animal welfare but aren't put at further competitive disadvantage.
What we've done is look at these systems and compared them to barn housing, to free-range systems and organic systems. And while the enriched cages are a vast improvement on what went before, they still do not really provide the sort of health and welfare needs that we believe these animals require. So yes, they have some nesting space, some perching space and a scratch area, but they don't really have anywhere to dust bathe. They don't have access to outdoor space, for example, for foraging. And the space that the hens have within the enriched cages is much smaller than the space that they would be allowed in barn, free-range or organic systems. So we're talking just slightly bigger than the size of an A4 sheet of paper per hen within these enriched cages.
The NFU said in their statement to the consultation that a ban would simply increase the number of eggs being imported, some of which are produced to standards already illegal here. And they say that the British Veterinary Association rightly acknowledged the need for parity on import standards. And without that, the government is simply offshoring animal welfare. So they agree with your point, but they still think that enriched cages produce a valid product, which they say is at a price that people can afford.
It is a complicated issue, and there is a delicate balance to be had around pricing, around things like carbon footprint as well for producing these eggs. I think, you know, NFU and BVA both very rightly point out that if we don't have a kind of reciprocal arrangement with the eggs that are being imported into the country, then all this does is offshore the problem.
You might be okay if you try to implement a ban on enriched cages here in the UK. Only 20% of eggs are produced in that way. However, bringing it in for all imports would be much more difficult, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. It's a very complex area when we're talking about World Trade Organization rules or trade deals that are being made between UK government and other countries. There is no easy ban that can just be made for all eggs that come from these systems. However, there are different structures that the government has at its disposal to allow for these goods to be regulated and to allow for something along the lines of a mirror standards approach, for example, or bans that are linked to domestic bans. So there are different levers that the government have at their disposal. And what we are asking is that they use any structure that they have at their disposal to not offshore this problem.
Gwen Rees from the British Veterinary Association. A survey by the consumer group Which? Voted Northumberland National Park the best in the country, with its history, its peace and its facilities all scoring highly, but is also among the least visited. And that's something the park's former CEO, Tony Gates, has spent 20 years trying to change amid arguing with the government over the park's funding. A few days before he left his job, he met our reporter Joe Lonsdale at one of his very favourite spots.
We're smack bang in the middle of Hadrian's Wall, if you think it runs coast to coast across the north of England. And we've got the wonderful view of Craig Lough and the Great Windsill, which runs right through this central section of Hadrian's Wall.
So we've got a few walkers going past.
Hello.
This is a place where you really have constant walkers.
Yeah, Northumberland's got space. And it's very much a border landscape. And I think, having grown up in Northern Ireland, there's something about border places. You can almost feel their history.
So you came here 20 years ago. What do you think you'll look back on as the things you're most proud of?
What makes me proud? That it hasn't been despoiled. Some of England's cleanest rivers are in Northumberland National Park. We're on our way to restoring nature, so the curlew is less threatened than it has been in the past. Our relationship with the local landowning and farming community is something that we've always put great store by. In the last few years, we've been rolling out a programme called Farming in Protected Landscapes, which provides grant aid directly to farms, either for nature conservation work or for access projects or, you know, small projects to welcome people to the countryside. So I think it's been a really good relationship.
So we've come through the gate, we're just literally standing next to Hadrian's Wall. If we were to look over the top, we would be able to see the sill. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, that's something I'm very proud of. We built it as a National Landscape Discovery Centre. We built it to carry 100,000 visitors a year. It's never had less than 120. What I'm most proud of is seeing the people who engage with it. watching the school group we've just watched walk up the crags, and they're staying overnight in the youth hostel. We built the youth hostel.
The wind's picking up a bit, isn't it?
If you dip down behind there.
Obviously, we've touched on the things that you're most proud of there, but there's been a struggle, hasn't there? And that's about how you're funded.
Yes, there's quite a complex formula which government uses for funding national parks. But the long and short of that is Northumberland's never had its fair share of that. And I've had many battles over many years with government over this.
And since 2019, you've had the same amount of cash each year. So effectively, your funding's been cut, in real terms anyhow.
Yeah, but we've got the same job to do. You know, you get to a point where you're really struggling to do your statutory work, just the things you must do to operate legally. And you think, how serious are government about this? Landscapes, when you go run down through the list, define what the country is. The Lake District, the Peak District, the Broads, Dartmoor, Exmoor, the Yorkshire Dales and North York Moors, Northumberland. We've had the COVID pandemic. What did that show us? That people absolutely need open spaces and national parks just as much. So that's why government should fund them, because they're good for people.
That report by Joe Lonsdale. Farmers at the Pig and Poultry Fair this week were comparing notes about a serious problem with out-of-sync supply and demand. And some pig farmers are finding themselves in a precarious position, with prices falling and pigs starting to back up on farms. The supermarket Morrisons has given notice to some of its farmers because of an oversupply in the market. It blamed the challenging economic climate. I asked editor of Pig World, Alistair Driver, about the extent of the backlog.
A lot of people are experiencing it to some extent. So maybe pigs are staying on for a couple of weeks longer than would otherwise be the case. They're getting heavier. They're managing it. Some people that are worst affected are, you know, starting to burst at the seams. So it's bad, it's prolonged.
Just give us some of the reasons why this is happening.
It's just a combination of factors, really. In response to what was a relatively good time, some of the bigger companies have expanded herds, put more sows down. Last year, we had some good growth rates, good breeding productivity. That was compounded in the autumn by one of the big factories had a couple of weeks' maintenance. That created a bit of a backlog on farms. Demand, generally, it's been flat. The demand just hasn't been there. Pigs have built up gradually on farms. Some people worse affected than others, depending on their supply chains. Allied with it, I'm afraid, we've seen a downturn in European prices. That has put, not necessarily import pressure, it's not necessarily that more is being imported to displace it, but it's put price pressure on. So the price has been falling. Add into that mix, you've got the war in the Middle East. That's starting to push up cost.
We know that Morrisons has given notice to some of its suppliers.
Well, that's kind of the biggest manifestation so far of what's happening as a result of all of this. I think all of the supply chain is kind of looking at its numbers, you know, across the board. Morrisons is blaming the general economic conditions, that the downward pressure on price. But yes, it's given generally, typically it will be 6 months' notice, but including some pretty big suppliers. And it's also apparently informed others that it will be cutting back on numbers. So it's happening across the board, but that's the kind of the most obvious headline impact so far.
Do you think other supermarkets will follow?
Slightly different in that Morrisons owns its own abattoirs. It's more about the relationship between the producers and the processors. And I think it may be happening at a less kind of high profile level, but it's kind of inevitable when you have this, really what is just an imbalance in the supply chain. And the problem is, for anybody that's been given notice, it's not the sort of environment where it's easy to pick it up elsewhere. However, I don't want to make it all sound doom and gloom. This is the pig sector. It is always cyclical. It will turn. The question on everybody's lips is kind of when and at what cost.
Editor of Pig World, Alistair Driver. Well, the threat of disease was another hot topic at the Pig and Poultry Fair, with Farming Minister Angela Eagle there to announce a new strategy on African swine fever. It's a very infectious virus found in pigs and pig meat. It doesn't affect people, but pigs can infect each other. It can also travel on boots or car tyres, and if someone discards infected meat, like a ham sandwich, it could be eaten by a wild boar boar or pig, which then gets the disease. ASF, as it's known, has been gradually spreading across Europe. Earlier this year in Spain, there was an outbreak involving more than 150 cases. It hasn't reached the UK yet, but the government here has already banned all personal meat imports from other countries. The government says the new strategy will help farmers avoid blanket movement restrictions, reducing pressures such as overcrowding and enabling day-to-day operations to continue more smoothly. The new measures also apply to classical swine fever, which did break out in the UK back in 2000 when 180,000 pigs had to be slaughtered as animal movement restrictions led to overcrowding. I asked the chief vet, Christine Middlemiss, what the new strategy means for farmers.
So it's all about making the framework, while still effective for disease control, a bit more tailored, responsible, flexible to the actual on-the-ground situation.
Are you releasing this strategy because you think the threat is imminent?
So we've been at medium risk of the incursion of African swine fever actually for a few years now. Most of that is because of the slow westward spread in Europe from wild boar. We do see these long distance jumps into Italy, into Belgium at one point, Germany and so on. And we're very mindful of that. We've learned a lot from how the Europeans and the Caribbean and others have been responding to their outbreaks. So, for example, this flexible approach. And we've taken those learnings and put them into the new strategy.
The reason why African swine fever crosses countries is often due to illegal imports of meat. Now, we've reported many times about the problem here in the UK. Last month, Dover Port Health Authority told us they intercepted more than 14.2 tonnes of illegal meat in the last week of March alone. So doesn't that have to change first?
So we continue to work with Dover and provide them with funding to look at exactly this, to pick up these illegal movements of meat. And the fact that they're finding some, whilst disappointing, means that having the checks is effective. But yes, managing the illegal imports continues to be really important, as does biosecurity at farm level too, and our ongoing advice about don't feed food products to pigs, even if you're out walking around and they're feral pigs.
The Environment, Food and Rural Affairs Select Committee heard that lorry loads of legal imported meat failing to get inspected at Sevington for their vet inspections. Now, have you got a hold of that? Because that obviously means that even though this stuff is legal, it's not getting inspected.
Well, it has documentary checks, which for me is the really important part. And because that's the bit, as you say, that, you know, you check the export health certificate online and you can see, yes, it's come from a listed establishment. It's come from a part of a country that we know doesn't have disease. Those for me are the really critical checks in relation to animal health. We are working with both Sevington and the Inland Trading Standards and local authorities about following up on lorries that don't stop. Those are particularly for their physical checks of the product, which for animal disease is probably a bit less important. It's those export health certificates signed off by an official vet in the other country that really matter to me.
There is to be a new alignment with the EU. That's mentioned in the King's Speech. That's supposed to make trade much easier, but doesn't it also mean that there's more of a threat if checks are slightly eased?
Well, being back in a single market or a single SPS area, so animal health area, if you like, will mean that we will have access again to the IT systems and intelligence that is within the EU, which we don't have at the moment. And that will be hugely helpful, understanding really quickly on the ground what disease situations are and working as a member of that single market to make sure it's controlled in the country of origin. So that, if you like, for me, is a kind of trade-off. You get access to that intelligence, the systems and things.
These things have to be joined up, though, don't they? The strategy that you're announcing to deal with the disease if it gets here and the prevention of the disease getting here.
Oh, absolutely. You've got to do prevention,
detection, response, and then a really important part for us that we maybe don't talk about so much is recovery. So, you know, you've had an outbreak, but the key is to get back to disease-free status and back to trade again, because that's what drives product through the market.
Chief Vet Christine Middlemiss. Northern Ireland's biggest agricultural show, the Balmoral Show, is drawing to a close today. More than 100,000 people have visited the showground in Lisburn, southwest of Belfast, over the last 3 days. And more than 3,000 animals have been paraded around the show ring. It's one of those events that attracts the whole of the region, urbanites and countryside dwellers alike. Louise Cullen was there for Farming Today to discuss the politics of Northern Ireland agricultural policy. But first, she experienced the emotional pressure of the exhibitors who've spent the last year working towards the final showdown in the ring.
Sheep's just gone for a run around the ring there, but she's got a red rosette. We've got an emotional winner coming out here, an emotional owner. Oops, they're wrestling the sheep. Well, that win clearly meant a lot to you. Why is it so important to you, this red rosette?
She's special, just very friendly, so we love her, you know. We didn't think she'd be able to do it because she had two bad legs as a lamb, so we were told she was never going to be a show sheep, and then she goes and does that. When in her class, it was very unexpected.
I'm just walking around the sheep area here, and we've got these fabulous sheep that look like they've overdone the bronzer. So you're doing a little bit of cleaning around the legs. Yes. So tell us about this beautiful breed.
They're originally from France. They're Rouge l'Ouest. They're translates into Red of l'Ouest. That explains the face and leg colour. We've been breeding them for 34 years now, so we like them for their easy lamb and just easy maintained.
So what do you do to them then before the show?
Their legs and faces would be trimmed, wool would be washed and then spray at it to give a wee bit of colour.
And how hopeful are you of taking home a rosette?
They're here anyway and we can't have them looking any better, so we'll see how we get on.
It's a little bit grey, but that's certainly not taking the edge off. The people are streaming through the Ulster Farmers Union enclosure. Also under cover is the union's new president, John McLenaghan. Lovely to see you, John.
Louise,
congratulations.
How are you?
Yep. You're just new in post. What are your priorities?
It's about taking this industry forward. It's about representing our members. It's about having a farming environment that allows them to continue those generational farm businesses that we are so much a characteristic of Northern Ireland farming.
But of course you're doing this against a backdrop of an awful lot of challenges, and they range from global geopolitical right down to local, don't they?
Challenges are part of farming. Weather challenges, we talk about the geopolitical challenges, the effects of what we're currently seeing from the American war in the Middle East. I think this has highlighted the need to actually protect and create a resilience, not just within the individual farming businesses, but more at a national level. So how do we protect ourselves from these type of geopolitical shocks? We stopped producing fertiliser in the UK about 3 years ago. That makes us vulnerable. So and we did that because it was cheaper to buy it from somewhere else. That's the sort of long conversations we have to sit down and have and say, it's not just about the cost of some of these items, it's about that resilience and that availability of product at times when things get difficult. And an increase in fertiliser now is an increase in food later.
That's kind of looking externally, but looking inwardly, we're waiting for a new Nutrients Action Programme. This is the programme that basically tackles water pollution from agricultural sources. It's been in place for nearly 20 years. We know that it had a slightly challenged consultation last year. We're now waiting on the Stakeholder Task and Finish Group coming back with a final document. What do farmers need from that plan?
We have spent an awful lot of time and effort in actually turning that around into something which actually will work at a farm level and will deliver in terms of water quality at an environmental level. And I think we're very close to having that all finalised.
But why the pushback when we know that you look at Loch Ness and we know that agriculture is responsible for the bulk? There are other elements, of course, wastewater, septic tanks, industry, and every single household in that catchment all play a part. But agriculture is responsible for the bulk of nutrient pollution in Loch Ness, contributing to the blue-green algae crisis. Why has there been that pushback?
I wouldn't accept that that agriculture is responsible for the bulk of those nutrients. There are many factors which have led to the Loch Nye situation, and I think if we think too much about the percentages and who's responsible for what, we actually miss the bigger point, which is how do we actually fix this? As an industry, we have demonstrated over the last 15, almost 20 years of a nitrates programme, what we have done as an industry in order to change practice, invest on our farms, improving water quality. We do manage our nutrients, we will continue to manage our nutrients, and we will do that in a way which actually maximises profit on our farms, because we do not want to see nutrients lost into Loch Nye or any other water catchment.
Well, you're going to have a steady flow of members through this marquee today. They're all lining up for the tea already. I better let you go and get pouring.
Thank you, Louise.
The crowds are still watching to see which sheep take the prizes in the rings. Leaning on the railings here is the Agriculture, Environment and Rural Affairs Minister at Stormont, Andrew Muir. All right, well, Minister, we've had the great announcement here at Balmoral, of course, that the BBC Food and Farming Awards are coming to Northern Ireland for the first time. How excited are you to see a celebration like that coming to Northern Ireland?
Absolutely overjoyed, and I want to say thank you to everyone who's made this possible. This will be a real showcase for Northern Ireland, showing what's great in terms of our agri-food sector here. I know we've got challenges, but we have that real competitive edge. We have that really high-quality food, but also produced to the highest welfare standards.
You mentioned the challenges. Of course, the big talking points here will be the three Fs. Farming is not the only F. Feed, fuel and fertiliser. So what about farmers here? What are they getting from you?
And that's going to be the key issue that I'm raising with the DEFRA Secretary of State, because the UK government need to step up and support our farming community across the UK. And those challenges in terms of the cost of fuel, feed and fertiliser is something where they have the economic firepower to be able to get that support out. Because we're going to see this coming through in terms of food inflation. That could be up to about 10%, and I'm really concerned around that.
And of course, we've had the EFRA Secretary of State, Emma Reynolds, here today. You've got that access. What are you telling her?
So I'm making it very, very clear. We need that support in terms of those additional costs in terms of fuel, feed and fertiliser, but also in terms of this SPS Agri-Food Agreement. It's important to get that over the line and get it implemented as soon as possible. So I want to see that summit again taking place either next month or the beginning of July and get it implemented in 2027. We need to do that so that we can actually help trade across the whole of the UK and help our agri-food system in Northern Ireland.
And what about then those wider big picture issues that farmers are facing around pollution, the intensive livestock farming that we have here? How do they meet those pollution regulations, the Nutrients Action Programme requirements to moderate water pollution from agriculture? How do they meet those without extra government support?
So I'm very clear that government needs to assist a just transition so we can address those environmental issues. And that's why I'm going to be rolling out Sustainable Farm Investment Scheme in terms of that capital support. We also have over £300 million in terms of a Sustainable Agriculture Programme. But addressing those issues, we've got to do them together. And that's why we've set up a task and finish group in relation to the Nutrients Action Programme. I'm quite hopeful that will be completed in the next few weeks and we'll do a final consultation in regards to this and then we'll be able to move forward. Together we can achieve so much more. I know we've got challenges, but I'm a glass half full type of person and I'm someone who wants to get things done.
Minister of Agriculture, Environment and Rural Affairs of Northern Ireland, Andrew Muir there with Louise Cullen at the Balmoral Show. That's all for today. I'm Anna Hill. The producer was Beatrice Fenton. Farming Today this week was a BBC Audio Bristol production.
Thank you, Anna. Now, 11 years ago, Anna was on a farm in Suffolk where the owners, David and Sharon McVeigh, had decided to start handing over the reins to their children with big plans from glamping to managing the crops on 450 acres of land. On this week's On Your Farm, Anna's back there to see how the family's got on. That's tomorrow morning at 6:30. Tonight here on Radio 4, we're looking at another important element of British life, the pub. With hundreds closing every year, how can we save our favourite alcohol and non-alcoholic beverage-fuelled informal parliaments? More on that on the life and many debts of the local tonight at 8 o'clock. Now, let's get a full roundup of the weather. Here is Elizabeth Rizzini.
Thanks, Fiji. Well, look, some really slow changes happening weather-wise this weekend. Temperatures are still below the seasonal average, but it will be warming up next week. Still a lot of weather to get through before then, with plenty of showers too. For many of us, it's been a chilly start to the morning with a touch of frost across Scotland and Northern England in particular. There's a front moving in from the west. It's bringing cloud and some outbreaks of rain. rain generally. So for Northern Ireland, South West England and Wales, already a cloudy start. Outbreaks of rain in the far west, they'll be pushing further eastwards. So further east across much of Scotland and England, then it's bright and chilly this morning. The sunshine will last longest towards parts of East Anglia and across parts of Aberdeenshire, the far north of Scotland too. The cloud in the west will be moving further eastwards. By the time we get to the middle of the afternoon, I think it will be cloudy for most parts of the UK. For western Scotland, Wales, northwest England and southwest England, outbreaks of rain through the afternoon. For Northern Ireland, behind the weather front, sunshine and showers developing. A light to moderate westerly to southwesterly wind. So with the change of wind direction, it should feel a bit milder, but not dramatically so, I have to say today. 11 to 13 Celsius in the north, 13 to 15 Celsius further south. Overnight tonight, the cloud and rain continue to push further eastwards. For Northern Ireland and for much of the western half of the UK, scattered showers and some clear spells. For southeast England, we'll keep that thicker cloud till dawn. We've still got those gentle westerly winds. It will be a frost-free night with overnight lows of 5 to 8 degrees Celsius. Into tomorrow, it's quite a messy picture. Frost-free start, obviously, as across Scotland, Northern Ireland and Northern England, expect to see some heavy thundery showers, mostly dry further south and east, but it could be rather cloudy at times.
Thank you, Elizabeth. On Tuesday, Radio 4 explores an outdoor revolution.
This is a story about a trinity of women. These women loved plants more than they loved being liked.
Juliet Stevenson features in a two-part drama about three British female horticulturalists.
A garden is not a place for a woman.
Then it's terribly lucky I don't behave like one.
The remarkable stories of Gertrude Jekyll, Ellen Wilmot and Beatrix Potter.
Father, I am tired of rooms that will not have me.
Women who chose defiance over approval.
Make trouble.
Trimorous. Three Heroines Unearthed begins on Tuesday afternoon at 2:15 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 4.
It's 7 o'clock on Saturday the 16th of May. Good morning, this is Today with Katja Adler and Justin Webb.
The headlines this morning. Police say drones, helicopters and facial recognition will be used to ensure public safety as two rival protests take place in central London. We'll explore what policing these events should look like and how to balance freedom and security. A ceasefire between Lebanon and Israel has been extended, but Israeli airstrikes have continued in the south of the country.
And also coming up in this hour. An opera, an exhibition and a play. What's behind the new fascination with Frida Kahlo? And we'll hear why the bugs of the garden are the stars of this year's Chelsea Flower Show. And... it is Eurovision final tonight. Can the broadcasters unite under the glitter ball, or will boycotts and voting controversies take the shine off the competition?
Good morning, I'm Dalith Lloyd with your Saturday Sport. Aston Villa secure Champions League football next season as Rory McIlroy recovers to move to within five shots of the lead at the USPGA Championship.
The BBC News read this morning by Vijay Alice.
Thousands of police will be on the streets of London today to manage two large protests in what the Met Commissioner has called one of the most significant policing operations in years. There will be what's called a sterile zone managed by officers between one march organised by the far-right figure Tommy Robinson and a pro-Palestinian demonstration. Facial recognition technology will be deployed, and prosecutors have urged police to intervene if chanting or slogans breach the law. In addition, tens of thousands of football fans are expected at Wembley Stadium for the FA Cup final. Tom Simons reports.
Tommy Robinson has called for a demonstration to unite the kingdom. Last year, around 150,000 turned out to a similar event. The Palestine Solidarity Campaign will commemorate the dispossession of Palestinians in 1948, and oppose Robinson's march. Police will use a facial recognition unit to spot suspects and drones, helicopters and temporary lamppost-mounted cameras to monitor the crowds. 11 prominent far-right speakers have been banned from entering Britain. Police will also be watching and listening closely to the Palestine Solidarity protest. Prosecutors have advised police to step in and deal with chants and slogans which may breach hate crime laws.
Labour has begun the process of choosing a candidate for the Macclesfield by-election, which may decide Sir Keir Starmer's future. Andy Burnham, the Mayor of Greater Manchester, has been cleared to put his name forward by the party's ruling National Executive Committee. He is likely to challenge the Prime Minister's leadership if he wins the seat. Mr. Burnham's supporters in Labour argue that he has the ability to communicate effectively with voters, while some of his opponents have accused him of behaving in an entitled manner. Our political correspondent, Damien Grammaticus, reports.
Midday on Monday is the deadline for potential Labour candidates for the Makerfield by-election to come forward. If there are others alongside Andy Burnham, Labour will decide a shortlist, hold hustings and make a final choice on Thursday. The by-election itself could be in 5 weeks' time. At that point, a challenge could come to Sir Keir Starmer's leadership, whether from Andy Burnham or another contender. But winning the by-election will not be straightforward for Mr. Burnham. Reform picked up 50% of the votes in the area in the recent local elections. It will select a candidate this week, and the Greens said they will enter the contest too. The Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson told Radio 4's The Week in Westminster she would back Mr. Burnham's campaign in Makerfield, even though he may immediately seek to oust the Prime Minister.
Lebanon's health ministry says an Israeli airstrike on a civil defence in the south of the country has killed 6 people, including 3 paramedics. Last night, the US State Department announced that the ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon had been extended for another 45 days. From Jerusalem, Emir Nader reports.
On paper, a renewed ceasefire is in place, but any hopes that this new phase will be a true halt to the violence already appear to be in question. The killing of 3 rescue workers adds to the more than 100 paramedics killed by Israeli airstrikes since the latest round of fighting broke out in March. Hundreds in Lebanon and 6 Israeli troops have been killed since the ceasefire came into effect a month ago. The State Department said the ceasefire extension agreed yesterday would enable further progress, while Lebanese officials say it's a step towards a real end to the fighting. The thorny issues of Hezbollah disarmament and Israeli withdrawal from southern Lebanon are still to be negotiated in further US brokered talks in the weeks ahead.
Israel says it's carried out airstrikes in Gaza, targeting a senior Hamas commander who it accuses of helping to mastermind the October the 7th attacks. It's not been confirmed whether Izzaldin al-Haddad has been killed. The emergency services in Gaza City say the Israeli strikes killed at least 7 people. President Trump has warned Taiwan against formally declaring independence, saying he talked for a whole night about the issue with China's President Xi during his visit. Asked by Fox News whether the people of Taiwan should feel more or less secure after his visit to Beijing, Mr. Trump replied neutral. Officials in Taiwan, which is claimed by China, said they were thankful for the president's long-standing support. Our correspondent Joel Gunther was watching the interview.
Washington has traditionally maintained a policy of so-called strategic ambiguity towards Taiwan, sticking to a script of no comment on whether it would defend the self-governing island militarily. President Trump, not someone known to stick to the script, told Fox News last night that he was not looking to travel 9,500 miles for a fight with China over the island. China's President Xi will be happy to hear that and pleased, for now, that Mr. Trump is still withholding a planned $14 billion arms sale to Taiwan. Mr. Trump's remarks don't spell a significant shift for U.S. policy, however. The official position on Taiwan, according to Secretary of State Marco Rubio, remains unchanged.
President Trump has said that the U.S. and Nigerian forces have killed a senior figure in the Islamic State group. In a social media post, he described Abu Bilal al-Minuki as the most active terrorist in the world and said he would no longer terrorize the people of Africa or plan operations to target Americans. The Scottish FA has warned against intolerance and hysteria as the Premiership season builds to a dramatic climax with Hearts facing Celtic for the title. A 19-year-old man has been charged with a data protection offence after personal details of the referee who awarded a controversial penalty to Celtic on Wednesday were leaked online. The SFA said vigilantism was a scourge on the game. Our correspondent Lorna Gordon reports.
Hearts and Celtic are separated by just a point at the top of the Scottish Premiership. If the Edinburgh side clinch the title, it will be the first time in 66 years. The decider has gripped the country, but tensions have been running high. The referee who awarded Celtic a controversial late penalty on Wednesday and his family have been under police protection. The Scottish Football Association is urging tolerance and perspective. There are concerns also about the safety of fans. Police Scotland has criticised Celtic's lack of planning for an official title party should they win. That description of the club's behaviour is disputed by Glasgow City Council.
The Eurovision final takes place tonight in Vienna as the song contest marks its 70th anniversary. The UK is being represented by an inventor, Sam Battle, known as Look Mum, No Computer, who's been spending his time preparing for the event, building some of the set for his performance. His mother, Jane, told the BBC her son had been very busy.
It's been a whirlwind. It's totally mad, and yeah, I'm so proud of him, so proud of him. He works really hard. I mean, it seems to have been going on for a long time by the time all the process of choosing. So yeah, it's been a very exciting time. He's looking forward to it a lot. He's thoroughly enjoying it, but I haven't spoken to him since he came to Vienna.
Jane Battle there.
Thank you very much, Vijay. It is 8 minutes past seven and time to have a look at the newspapers this morning, which unsurprisingly in their front pages are very much focusing on political turmoil and threats to Keir Starmer's leadership. The FT Weekend has a front page headline, "The UK risks paralysis amidst Labour fight." The paper says that ministers and civil servants are warning as the growing likelihood of a Labour leadership contest threatens to overshadow Starmer's agenda. There could be delays for the push for closer EU ties, says the paper, other key initiatives will be disrupted, it says, as Greater Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham seeks a return to Parliament to challenge Starmer. Where you have the Daily Mail, who says that Keir Starmer faces his Waterloo with this challenge from Andy Burnham. The paper says no one would mistake Andy Burnham for the Duke of Wellington, but he'll begin to win the Commons seat and topple the Prime Minister, and that would be in the by-election on the anniversary of the famous battle, says the paper, at the crushing defeat of Napoleon Bonaparte in 1815 on June the 18th.
And talking of the coming battle, Nigel Farage has been talking to the Daily Express, vowing to give Labour leadership contender Andy Burnham a very nasty shock, ending his hopes of returning to Parliament, pledging to throw everything we can, as he put it, at the Makefield by-election. And senior Labour politicians, the Express claims, admitting that Reform UK could pull off a stunning win, excuse me, in the constituency. The I paper also suggesting that Andy Burnham's return is going to be not quite as easy as some might suggest, particularly focusing in its front page story on his views on Brexit, or at least what his views are going to be when he approaches voters in that constituency. He vows, the I says, to soften his stance on Brexit. Allies say Burnham's going to shift his stance on Brexit to avoid alienating voters open to reform, and he won't mention rejoining the EU.
The Guardian newspaper points out that Keir Starmer may be unpopular, but it says he's far from alone amongst major European leaders. We've got some statistics here. According to the data platform Statista, says the paper, 27% of the public approve of Keir Starmer, 65% don't, 8% to be said unsure. But the numbers are even more dire, says The Guardian, for Friedrich Merz of Germany. Only 19% approve of him, 76% disapprove. And Emmanuel Macron of France, 18% approving, 75% disapproving. Well, that makes Keir Starmer feel better, do you think, Justin?
Momentarily is the answer to that, probably. 12 minutes past seven is the time. Let's talk about the policing of these marches in London today, and we'll do it with Daniel Stanford, our Home Affairs correspondent. It is going to be a challenge, isn't it, Daniel, for everyone concerned?
Yes, I mean, obviously everyone hopes it'll all pass off peacefully, but the police have said that these two marches today cause a significant cause for concern and require a policing plan that provides the most assertive grip. And that is going to be very visible, I think, in parts of central London today, with mounted officers, police dogs, drones, police helicopters, and even the presence of some specialist armed vehicles, which the police say are available for use as a very high-level contingency option. There's quite strict controls on both marches on where they can go, on what time they have to end. And then there is this use of live facial recognition, not on the marches, but at one of the areas in London where the people attending Tommy Robinson's march are likely to arrive in London, in other words, around the Euston, King's Cross and St Pancras station. So it's right at the top end of policing of marches today.
And when it comes to the placards that can be shown and the slogans that can be shouted, is there a change, Daniel?
Yes, it's not a change that is very specifically starting today. There's been a shift in recent weeks, particularly on the marches to pro-Palestinian marches, where they've taken a more assertive approach to what people can chant on those marches. So, for example, chants around globalising the Intifada and death of the IDF, the Israeli armed forces, are now being considered as chargeable. The reason for that is that because of the recent attacks on the Jewish community in North London, things like globalised intifada are seen as being encouraging of attacks like that. There's also, interestingly, conditions on both marches that the organisers are responsible for ensuring that people who speak do not use hate crime speech or extremism. So the organisers potentially can be held responsible if any of the official speakers breach rules around hate crime. So that's actually also a shift. And clearly placards are included in that. If somebody was carrying a placard that said something like globalise the intifada, then potentially they could find themselves being charged. And the Crown Prosecution Service is accelerating the speed with which hate crime cases go from charge to court. So a bit like what happened during the riots of 2024, people won't get charged and then wait a few weeks or months before going in court. They could potentially find themselves in court convicted if found guilty, and then punished within a matter of days.
But not necessarily arrested at the moment that the offence or alleged offence takes place, is that right?
I mean, clearly there are a lot of police officers being deployed today, 4,000 police officers, that's the most being deployed on a public order event in recent years. But if there was a mass disobedience of those rules, it would be literally impossible for the police to manage that. So they will arrest people when they see it happening today, if they can, and if not, then obviously the video evidence is now very, very widely used in these public order events, and people can find a knock on the door weeks or even months afterwards if there's video of them either chanting or holding a placard, which is thought to have breached the anti-hate crime laws.
Daniel Sanford, thank you.
It's 7:15. Israel announced yesterday evening it had killed the Hamas commander Izzaz-Din al-Haddad, who it described as one of the architects of the October the 7th massacre, it said. That was in an airstrike on Gaza City. Also yesterday, Israel agreed to extend the ceasefire with Lebanon for another 45 days. That was at the end of a second round of US-sponsored negotiations between Israel and the Lebanese government. Well, for more on both of those stories, I'm joined by Emir Nader, the BBC correspondent in Jerusalem. Good morning, Emir.
Good morning.
First of all, what more can you tell us about Israel's claim of this killing of a key Hamas commander?
We've been speaking to a number of eyewitnesses in Gaza who said they saw a number of airstrikes targeting an apartment block in Gaza City. They said they saw a body being taken out and a number of survivors who were injured trying to leave by car. Other eyewitnesses then told us that that car was subsequently struck by further airstrikes. So what we don't have is an official confirmation from the Israeli government or from Hamas. And we have been in this position before with other attempted assassinations of Hamas leaders, where first we get this statement from an unnamed Israeli security official saying they believe that it looks like they've been successful. And we're at that stage now. We might indeed get the official confirmations later, but if they have indeed killed Ezzedine al-Haddad, it will be a significant blow to the leadership of Hamas. Of course, he was a mastermind of October the 7th. But it is also unlikely to break the deadlock around the current status of the Gaza ceasefire.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, as you mentioned the word ceasefire there is officially a ceasefire in place over Gaza, but Israeli strikes continue and rockets continue to be fired from inside the Gaza Strip at Israel. Another ceasefire that's described of in name only is that in Lebanon. As I was saying, there was a second round of US-sponsored negotiations between the Lebanese government and the Israeli government. But, of course, Hezbollah, which is backed by Iran, the armed group, doesn't recognise the ceasefire, and the violence continues. Overnight, there were more Israeli strikes as well.
That's right. And I think the fear is that the ceasefire agreed to yesterday, the extension, will be much of the same as the past month of the ceasefire between Lebanon and Israel, whereby we've seen hundreds of Lebanese people killed in Israeli airstrikes. Israeli troops have expanded their occupation in the south of the country. You have a million Lebanese people still displaced. Hezbollah, in turn, have been more bold and more accurate in their targeting. We've seen a sixth Israeli soldier killed just in the past couple of days, and more drone strikes into northern Israel. So what we don't know is if this recent agreement in the US yesterday, if they've agreed to further reduce the violence. So far, we're getting no sign of that. But what we understand is that it is paving the way towards further negotiations where those core issues would be addressed, the issues around Israeli withdrawal, the thorny issue of Hezbollah disarmament, and how this will all be sequenced. And indeed, many are looking towards the US to see how the United States will guarantee that process and really attempt to bridge the trust between the two parties where there is such a lack of it.
Emma Nader in Jerusalem, thank you.
It is 19 minutes past seven. The Chelsea Flower Show gets underway this weekend. There's a bit more of a focus, though, on what is going on underneath the flower beds. If you listen very closely now, you may even hear sounds like this. What on earth are those sounds? Apparently that's an earthworm, a beetle, an ant, and the mining bee, all recorded in the soil. Let's talk to Dr. Hazel Jackson, Biodiversity Science Director for the UK Centre for Ecology and Hydrology. Morning to you.
Good morning.
And this is a rethink, really, isn't it? Or part of a rethink, I suppose, of how we think about bugs.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at UKCEH, our scientists are really passionate about studying the environment across land, water and air and how it all connects, and in particular, our biodiversity. And people are naturally attracted to the more charismatic species, so butterflies and bumblebees, but perhaps less so to some of the things that we might think of as creepy crawlies, spiders, earwigs, woodlice. And it's really fundamental that we shift that thinking and appreciate those wonderful creatures and the role that they play across our landscapes and in our gardens.
And how is that going to be done at the Chelsea Flower Show this year in a way that it hasn't been done before?
So this is the first time we've been at Chelsea Flower Show. We're really excited. We've got a stand in the Green Stem Zone in the Grand Pavilion. And what we're going to be doing there is we're going to bring together citizen science, cutting edge technology, and visitors that come and see us can learn about wildlife friendly and climate resilient planting. They can learn about soil organisms that make noises, just as you just heard, and how we use that to understand ecosystem health. So we're really going to ask our visitors and people on the show today to get involved with recording insects in their gardens through citizen science apps such as iRecord. And this will be fundamental to not only helping conserve those insects and biodiversity in our gardens, but also to help us as scientists understand what's going on with those insects and how we can create solutions to tackle challenges of climate change and biodiversity collapse.
And you're pushing
the impact on people.
Well, exactly. And it's an open door, really, isn't it, this for you? Because you've got people at Chelsea who are going to be concerned about all these things, even if they haven't been drawn to their attention before in quite the way that you're doing it this time round.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so many people now are really recognising the power of their gardens and what they can plant in their gardens to help our insects and our birds and our mammals, and how they can, you know, those small actions can make a really big difference. So, you know, I'm really interested to see how we can work with people, as I said, not just to conserve wildlife and actually appreciate all of those lovely little creatures and the roles that they play for food for birds, for managing levels of other insects in the garden like mosquitoes and aphids, through really simple interventions that they can make in their own gardens.
Dr. Hazel Jackson, Biodiversity Science Director for the UK Centre for Ecology and Hydrology. Thank you.
It's 22 minutes past seven.
If only there was a language that I could count in that would make me feel better. Oh, yeah.
That is Eins, Zwei, Drei, the UK's entry to the Eurovision Song Contest this year. I can see you love it, Justin. You were singing along there, actually. And it's by electronic artist Look Mum No Computer. He'll be performing this tonight at the Eurovision final in Vienna. It's the show's 70th anniversary, but it's been overshadowed by a huge row over Israel's participation. Iceland, Ireland, the Netherlands, Slovenia and Spain have all boycotted the event as a result. Well, Daniel Rosny is the BBC Eurovision correspondent. Good morning to you.
Good morning from Vienna.
Good morning. Now, it is supposed to be a joyous event. So let's start with the joy. What should we look forward to tonight and what will you be wearing?
What will I be wearing? That's a very good question. I think probably something. I in the past I've wore a tux. You've got to dress up for Eurovision.
What colour, though? What colour tux?
Event. I need to get a gold bow tie, maybe.
Sounding good.
But the stage itself, the artists themselves, they're dressed and impressed. Now, it is the world's largest live music event. And for these artists, they've been rehearsing for months and months and months. And they desperately want to get points from across Europe. I was lucky enough to see last night's show. So last night is where they get half of the points. It's the judges. It's the competition's juries. And I think the one to watch actually this year is Australia. And for the first time in the 11 years that Australia has been competing, I think it could win.
So again, I can't stop an eyebrow raise when I hear Australia, because, you know, Eurovision, and of course we know it has gone beyond the boundaries of Europe, and in fact this political row this year was over Israel, is the biggest boycott in Eurovision 70-year history. Do you think that this, as we said, it's supposed to be a joyous event, can survive the politics of the moment?
So within minutes of Austria winning last year, and the prize is you get to put it on the following year, it was referred to, the 2026 contest last year was referred to as the Platinum Jubilee. The Platy Jubes is back. And I think organisers wanted a much more celebratory event this year. But because we have those five broadcasters boycotting, and it is a broadcasting event, it is a competition that the BBC enters, not that the government enters, they sort of watered down their plans slightly. In the city itself, it does have a slight sort of reminiscent of an Olympics, because it's the biggest event in music. And you've got fan parks here, you've got events and cafes, embassies are getting involved. But because of those five broadcasters withdrawing, it certainly has cast a shadow over it. On Tuesday's semi-final, there were protests within the arena. There's protests outside of the arena planned today. And organisers say they're doing everything that they can to try to get those five broadcasters back next year. I think some are more likely than others for that to happen.
Now, you mentioned there, Daniel, that, and I think this is something I hadn't fully appreciated, that the Eurovision Song Contest, even though it's sort of, you know, United Kingdom, 10 points or whatever, that actually it's not the countries, it is a competition between broadcasters. And Russia, of course, was excluded in 2022. That was after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. But Eurovision said it was because of the behaviour of the state broadcaster rather than what the country had done.
Yes. So the European Broadcasting Union, it's a membership of public service broadcasters. And prior to Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, there was a Russian broadcaster that was a member of the European Union. There was three, actually. Currently, there are none. They've all been suspended. So Russia is ineligible to compete in Eurovision because it's no longer a member. Khan, which is the Israel public service broadcaster, is a member of the EBU. And the EBU says it hasn't broken any of its rules. And it has acknowledged that Khan itself has faced criticism from the Israeli government. But There is certainly concern amongst those broadcasters when it comes to press freedom, especially in relation to access to Gaza. And it could be argued that these broadcasters who are boycotting are themselves turning this into a political contest because they are, in theory, sending a message to the Israeli government.
And briefly, Daniel, there's also been a row over voting, the public voting system. This also involved Israel this year. Can you explain? I mean, Israel's government says it faces a global smear campaign, but can you explain briefly the row? And I mean, in concrete terms, what changes could be made to the rules to make Eurovision fairer?
So last year, and it had been for a number of years, you could vote up to 20 times. And the reason organisers say that's the case is because they imagine families are sat at home watching, family of five, they've all got different favourites, they're all using the same phone to vote, so it's going to split the vote from the public vote in terms of a household. Now, what happened last year, Israel overwhelmingly won the public vote. Some broadcasters were concerned, they didn't think that it was reflective of the popularity of the contest, so they've reduced the number of votes to 10. We won't actually know until this evening, probably until the early hours of tomorrow morning, how each individual country has done in each of those individual nations, but the competing broadcasters this year are certainly watching to see if there's been any disparity, not only with Israel, actually, but also with Ukraine. And that conversation is starting to happen between around Ukraine's diaspora around Europe and broadcasters' concerns that that is also influencing the public vote.
Daniel Rosny, thank you. Merci, danke.
28 minutes past seven. To the sport is Delith.
Good morning, Justin. Aston Villa have confirmed Champions League football for next season. Ollie Watkins scored twice as they beat Liverpool 4-2 to move above Arnaud Slot's side and into fourth in the Premier League. Salford City will face Notts County in the League Two playoff final. Both drew their semi-final second legs but progressed on aggregate. Partick Thistle will face St Mirren in a battle to secure Scottish Premiership football next season. And in Rugby Union's Premiership, leaders Northampton scored 14 tries as they thrashed Bristol by 94 points to 33. There were wins for Wigan Warriors and Wakefield Trinity in Super League. Now, Rory McIlroy has moved back into contention at the USPGA Championship in Pennsylvania after shooting a second round 3-under par 67. It puts him five shots behind the joint American leaders of Maverick McNealy and Alex Smalley. Let's speak to former European Open winner and part of Five Lives golf team, Andrew Murray. Good morning, Andrew.
Morning, Dallas. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Rory McIlroy is probably feeling much better today as well. I mean, he had a shocking opening round on Thursday, shooting four over. Friday's second round was vastly improved. What was the difference?
Yeah, well, that's the fickle nature of the game at that level, I guess, in some ways. Four bogeys to finish with. He's never done that in a major championship on day one, and that left him searching for a bit of form with the driver. He's still a little bit erratic yesterday, but no bogeys yesterday at all. The golf course is very difficult. It was very windy. It's getting more dried out after the storms. And it's a difficult place, only a par 70, which is quite unusual on the PGA Tour and for a major championship. So he's right back in it, which is terrific.
Is that why some of the top golfers have struggled then, that it is because it's such a challenging course?
Yeah, I mean, it's 7,400 yards, which is quite long. It's not very long for those guys, but it's still long. There's only two par fives where a lot of these guys tend to make up shots on the par. And, you know, that in itself makes it obviously more challenging. That's why the scoring is, I think, only 4-under is leading, isn't it? So, you know, anyone around about par is still absolutely in it. And certainly if you're Rory McIlroy, he'll feel very much part of the conversation over the weekend.
He will. I mentioned the joint American leaders, one of them the brilliantly named Maverick McNealy. Your ad hoc golfer, Andrew, might not be too familiar with him. What do we know about him?
No, we don't know a lot about him. We know he's a very established player. He's a winner on the PGA Tour. And he's no surprise to an American audience. Perhaps he is to us. But he's a terrific player. He won't be frightened of winning either. It would be his first major. But I can't see past a lot of the cream will rise to the top. Delith, I think Scottie Scheffler's in the frame. Rory, obviously. Matsuyama's right there, a major winner himself. So there's a lot of quality, serious quality, right behind those two.
Yeah, now that the cut has happened, as you say, the next two rounds will be interesting. The cream expected to rise to the top. World number one defending champion Scotty Scheffler is there challenging Spain's Jon Rahm thereabouts as well. And Scheffler's described the course as challenging. But fair to say then there's a few golfers, though, that could win this.
There's a couple of dozen that could win it, I think. There's 58 players within six shots, and you know, six shots, as Rory's just proved, is pretty straightforward to make up over two rounds, especially. So I think it'll come out of the top, maybe 15, top 20. Anybody round about Rory's score or better will be in the frame, no question.
Andrew, great to chat to you this morning. Enjoy the coverage a little bit later. The former European Open winner, Andrew Murray, they're part of the Five Lives golf team, of course. And McIlroy, by the way, tees off his third round at 4 p.m. UK time today.
Thank you very much, Dalith. It's 28 minutes to 8. Let's hear from Paddy O'Connell now with news of tomorrow's broadcasting house.
Hello. Must governing the UK topple our prime ministers? Conservative chaos has not ended with the arrival of Labour. Kemi Badenoch will be our guest, who has seen both eras from rival benches. Are you listening to us now in the newsmaker constituency of Makerfield? Please tell us something about the place by mailing bh@bbc.co.uk. We learn the names of British butterflies. Do you know your brimstone from your peacock? Do you prefer a grizzled skipper or a painted lady, as they tend to ask on Woman's Hour? BH is on BBC Sounds and here on Radio 4 from 9 tomorrow morning.
Oh, he's a cheeky boy, isn't he? 28 minutes to 8 is the time you're listening to today on Radio 4 with Katya Adler, Justin Webb and Vijay Ellis with the news.
Thousands of Metropolitan Police officers are preparing for what the Forces Commissioner has called one of the most significant operations in years, as two large protests will be held in London today. One march is being organised by the far-right figure Tommy Robinson, and the other is in support of Palestinians. What's been called a sterile zone will be set up by police between the two marches. Labour has begun the process of choosing its candidate for the Makerfield by-election, which could decide Sir Keir Starmer's future. The Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, has been cleared by Labour to put his name forward. Applications must be received by Monday. The US says Lebanon and Israel have agreed to extend their ceasefire for another 45 days, despite Israel continuing to launch strikes at Hezbollah in the country. The Iranian-backed militant group is not part of the truce and has attacked Israel. Lebanese officials say three paramedics were among six people killed overnight. The Israeli military says it has launched airstrikes at Gaza, targeting the head of the armed wing of Hamas. Israeli officials say he was one of the architects of the 7th of October attacks. It's not been confirmed whether Itz al-Din al-Haddad has been killed. President Trump has warned Taiwan against formally declaring independence, saying he talked for a whole night with China's President Xi about the issue. In an interview with American television, Mr. Trump said he had made no commitment either way on Taiwan's future, and he said he hadn't yet decided whether to go ahead with a major arms sale to the island. Taiwan sees itself as independent, but is claimed by China. And lawyers for the disgraced Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein have welcomed that a jury in New York was unable to reach a verdict on rape charges for the third time. The judge has ordered a mistrial. Weinstein remains in jail for other convictions and denies wrongdoing.
Thank you for that. It is just coming up to 25 to 8. When is a protest placard or a chant an actual incitement to racial hatred, and when is it acceptable as part of free speech that we all say we celebrate? That question, of course, far from academic. On the streets of London today, there's going to be a huge security operation to keep the two sides, one pro-Palestinian, the other organised by the anti-Islam campaigner Tommy Robinson, apart, but also to police what is shouted and the placards that are shown, and indeed speeches that are made at the rallies. Let us talk to Daniel Levy, who's on the line, president of the US Middle East Project, former Israeli peace negotiator himself, and to Lord Mann, John Mann, the government's independent advisor on anti-Semitism. Morning to you both.
Morning.
Morning.
And Daniel Levy, you intend to attend, do you, the pro-Palestinian rally?
I do. I plan to be there today. I think that's important because of what's going on here. I have been to some of these rallies. I'm not an attender at most of them, But today feels important. What's going on over here in terms of the attempts to stop this rally, and how I think that's a misstep for our democracy and for how we fight anti-Semitism. The fact that this is taking place on the same day and part of the rally is being against the far right and Tommy Robinson. I think that stands in the best traditions of Jewish opposition to racism and the far right in this country. For those who know their history, Cable Street should mean something. And it matters also for what's going on over there to commemorate the Nakba, the catastrophe of the expulsion of Palestinians, because if you can't do that, and I've sat as an Israeli negotiator discussing refugees and Nakba legacy, if you can't do that, then you're not going to have peace over there either. And that's part of a British colonial legacy where the UK government is still getting its policy wrong. And that's why we have to protest in this country as well.
And for you at the protest, what is acceptable when it comes to chants and slogans? In other words, if this chant, globalise the intifada, is made, is that, do you think, something the police should simply take no notice of? Is this something you would take no notice of?
Well, first of all, you're, of course, asking me what should and should not be chanted at the rally commemorating the Nakba against the far right. We're not going, apparently, into what can and can't be chanted at the Tommy Robinson far right rally. But in terms of that intifada, globalize the intifada, there is a great deal of ignorance. And I understand how in a time of tension, and make no mistake, this is a time where it is awful that the Jewish community, the community I'm a proud member of, is in palpable fear. We have to offer that security. But it shows a misunderstanding, and it matters the nuance. Intifada means in Arabic awakening, shaking off, uprising. It's about justice. Some people center it around justice for Palestinians. Some center it around fighting global injustice. But the go-to place is, this is violence. That's not the go-to place for the vast majority of the use of the term intifada.
Lord Mann, what would you say to that?
I'm not really sure what Mr. Neve is saying, because that's true. And for the minority, as opposed to the vast majority, globalised intifada is seen as a call to attack Jewish people, Jewish property. And some people have taken up that call. And so the police have a difficult job in handling protests. And the balance has always got to be this. Mr. Levy, in our country, should be allowed his right to free speech. If he or anybody else, it's incitement to Jewish people or anybody else in any context, or supports a terror organisation, then the police should, and I think will, arrest and prosecute. And the organisers of the demonstration should ensure that the people that they platform, give a microphone to, in front of how many thousands of people are marching, have a responsibility to ensure that their speakers stay within the law. And that's whether it's a far-right demonstration, this demonstration, or any other demonstration.
Daniel Levy, it is about context, isn't it? I mean, and as the police themselves say, you might discuss globalise the intifada in an academic setting, and that would be perfectly legitimate. But when it seems to be targeting individuals and seems to be leading to harm to those individuals, that's when it's unacceptable.
If that were the case, it would be unacceptable. But I'm sorry, you have to establish that thread of connectivity. And that thread of connectivity has not been established because it isn't there. The marches are peaceful marches. The marches are inclusive marches. When it's known that I'm there and there is a Jewish bloc there every week, that is treated with not just respect, but embraced in its open acknowledgement of Jewishness. If there are calls, of course Lord Mann is right. No one is questioning that. If there are acts of violence, aggression, if there are calls to commit acts of terror, of course that's not okay. But there are many of us, and I think this is a misattribution and a dangerous conflation to say that somehow protesting injustice of Israel is protesting against Jews. That's to conflate Israel and Jewishness. And there are many of us Jews who see our Jewish values as intimately bound up in a universal ethic that we must stand up for the rights of all people.
So let's turn then to what also ought to happen today, Lord Mann. Do you want to see the police standing back and allowing what they think they can allow? Do you want to see them intervening? How should they treat this march?
I'm sure the police will handle this, and the fact there's a competing match and lots of football fans, with great delicacy and care. And how the police manage it is very important. The police have very clear plans. They make the decisions. And I'm very impressed by the approach of the senior police in thinking through how to handle these things. I mean, there are people on these marches who've been arrested for breaking the law. That's a fact. And there may be some today on either or both marches. And that's right and proper. That's important. The other thing that's important, and the government's asked Lord MacDonald to review this, is that the police have the flexibility to also ensure that when there are marches taking place, the police have the flexibility to be able to negotiate properly with the march organisers to ensure that other people are not disproportionately impacted. And I give one example. If you're marching on a Saturday, there are Jewish people who will be walking to synagogues. If the march is regularly passing a synagogue, they're inhibited from doing so. And that has happened. That's what they've told me, those Jewish people. Well, they're also entitled to their freedom in this country. And the change I think we will see when Lord MacDonald reports is the flexibility for the police to say, yes, you can march in London, but you've marched the last time, the time before, and the time before in this way, from this place, point A to point B. This time, you're going to march in a different part of London. And I think that's reasonable as well. That's how marches in the past have been done. And that's an important principle, that people have the right to have their say in a free country, including Mr. Levy, and other people also allowed their competing right to go about their lives as they choose.
All right, well, we'll talk more about this, and particularly, actually, indeed, about the roots of the marches at 10 past eight. For the time being, there, Lord Mann, Daniel Levy as well. Thank you.
Well, what you're hearing there is from El Último Sueño de Frida y Diego, a new opera that's opened on Wednesday at the New York Metropolitan Opera. It's a Spanish work that imagines Mexican artist Frida Kahlo returning from the underworld on the Mexican Day of the Dead to confront her unfaithful husband, Diego Rivera. There's a lot of Frida Kahlo about these days. Next month, on the 25th of June, the Tate Modern's major exhibition, Frida, the Making of an Icon, opens. There's also a Netflix drama in the works, announced in March. It focuses on that tempestuous relationship between Frida Kahlo and her husband. So the Mexican artist, I mean, so unapologetically unconventional. She just seems more popular now than ever. What is it about her that appeals so much? Katie Hessel joins me in the studio, author of new children's book, The Story of Art Without Men. It has a chapter on Frida Kahlo. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
You're smiling and smiling as I say that. Well, maybe you were smiling at me falling over unapologetically, but I think Frida would not have apologised for stumbling, would she? I mean, she named all of her frailties, all of her mistakes so vibrant.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Frida is the icon of our times. The Tate Modern title has that exactly right. You know, when we think about women in history, not only was she the artist, but she made herself the subject. She put herself front and central. She exposed her fears, her vulnerabilities, her loves on so many different levels. And so that, I think, is why people are resonating with her so much, especially children. You know, I go into schools and teach them the whole time about Frida Kahlo. And, you know, they are just gripped by her story. They're gripped by her images. She loved life. She loved nature. She understood the kind of doubleness that lived inside of us. She speaks to the really real core of humanity.
And pain. She understood human pain and suffering, didn't she? As well as all of that joy and vibrancy in her art.
Well, totally. You get the entire spectrum. You know, Frida Kahlo, when she was 6 years old, she suffered from polio, which left her with one leg shorter than the other. She was bedbound for a lot of her life, especially after the bus accident that she had when she was a teenager. And, you know, what she did was... She channeled that pain and that vulnerability into something beautiful. You know, when she was bedbound, her mum installed a mirror above her bed and gave her some paints. And, you know, she said, "I paint myself because I am so often alone and because I am the subject I know best." And she started painting her plaster carts. You know, when sort of kids have a broken leg or something, that's how she started. Again, making something shine that from something that had been broken. And I think it's that idea. You know, we live in a world where we're constantly looking for hope, constantly looking for something beautiful. And that's what she did. And she shows it. She shows it to us on the world stage.
And she was very much about human rights as well, wasn't she? She was a revolutionary. But I think the fact that she brings her person into her art so much, some compare her to modern day British artist Tracy Emin. Is that right, do you think?
Well, I think they're both icons. And I think what they do is they get to the heart of the human condition. I mean, Tracy Emin, she cuts through it like glass. And she talks about these subjects that were once considered, quote unquote, taboo. And they're actually just human subjects. They're subjects that all of us go through, especially women. They're just about life. And so when you see art and artists do that, you feel understood. You know, when you see a picture of Frida Kahlo crying these kind of crystal-like tears, you understand that she felt pain, she felt loneliness too. We all feel that. But looking at art can make us feel less alone. It can make us feel, okay, you went through that as well.
You're so passionate. I think anyone listening is going to just want to dive into all of these opportunities, whether it's opera, whether it's the Art at Tate Modern, or whether it's a Netflix drama. But if you were to choose three adjectives of people who are not familiar with Frida Kahlo to make people want to go and indulge, what would they be?
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, that's unfair, isn't it?
No, I think, you know, she was a revolutionary. She pretended that she was born in 1910 because she wanted to be part of that. Her last ever painter was Viva la Vida, Long Live Life. It speaks that, you know, she spoke to pain, but she also spoke to life and living. And that's why we're all here on this planet, to understand the beauty of it. And I think love, probably.
Katie Hessel, author of new children's book, The Story of Art Without Men, thank you.
8:12 makes my next line, so I'm very prosaic. The Chancellor will announce next week how she plans to help people with their higher energy costs because of the Iran war. Still, it is important, and we're going to be examining what that support is going to look like and at what price in just a moment. First, though, thought for the day. The speaker here in the studio is Martin Rowe, the writer on culture and spirituality. Morning to you, Martin.
Good morning. Reid Hoffman, one of the founders of LinkedIn, tells us that typing is over and voice-pilling is here. This is the word he's coined to capture the way, he says, we're set to bypass keyboards. After the quill, the pen, then the typewriter, the text, the voice note. But in voice-pilling, entire articles, essays or books, everything actually, is spoken directly to the machine for production, hands-free. Is voice-pilling a word that will stick? Sounds unlikely, but who knows? New words seem to be invented more rapidly than ever, but then language is always being born again. At an open mic event I was at this week, one poet used the beautiful expression sonder, the kind of neglected word from Chaucer or Shakespeare which etymologists and crossword compilers love to rediscover. Sonder is defined as the realisation that each person you pass by is the main character in their own story, in which you are just an extra. The definition comes from John Koenig in his Dictionary of Obscure Sorrows, a collection of words he created to capture emotions, he says, we feel but don't have the words to express. Some words or phrases disappear, some morph into new meaning, while others stick around forever. Few writers have had more stickability than William Tyndale. The 500th anniversary of his English New Testament is currently being celebrated in an exhibition at the British Library, and from next month at St Paul's Cathedral. Tyndale believed it shouldn't only be priests who could access the Bible, but that everyone should hear it in everyday English. His translation in 1526 was so popular that when King James commissioned his authorised version, nearly a century later, the Royal Translation Team ripped 90% of their text straight out of Tyndale. His phrases continue to haunt the language. From strength to strength, for better for worse, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Salt of the earth, and fight the good fight. Tyndale was after a poetic language understood by ordinary people, and was so successful that, as someone said, no Tyndale, no Shakespeare. Or as the playwright David Edgar put it, no Tyndale, no Kindle. But in democratising religion, in translating the divine into the human, he was branded the most dangerous man in England and burned at the stake. The political powers could see, to use another of his phrases, the writing on the wall. Words are dangerous. Once you can speak the divine in your own tongue, then you can bring God down from heaven onto earth and decide for yourself what your religion means for your life. You can, as Tyndale wrote, let there be light.
And that was Thought for the Day with Martin Rowe. Brings us to 9 minutes to 8.
This week, the government will unveil details of its targeted support for some households affected by the rise in energy costs resulting from the Iran war. Now, energy firms have been briefed on the plans, which might include support for lower income households and potentially the most intensive users of energy as well. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has also hinted at new measures to support businesses. They're being buffeted by all the global pressures at the moment. But with government spending under pressure and the cost of government borrowing on the rise, what should these measures look like? Can the government afford them? Questions for Ruth Curtis, Chief Executive of the Resolution Foundation, who joins me now down the line. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, Rachel Reeves is saying targeted very clearly, because she argues that when Liz Truss was Prime Minister facing that energy crisis after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, that universal payout led to higher taxes and wasted money. How do your former colleagues at the Treasury, used to be Director of Fiscal Policy there, work out who should get help now and how much?
Well, as you say, there is simply a trade-off between how much the Chancellor spends, who she supports, and at what level. There's no formula that tells you to the answer to that. Those are political judgments. The Chancellor's making this announcement next week ahead of Ofgem's announcement, which we're expecting in a fortnight's time, for the energy price cap in July. It now looks like that will be a rise in the energy price cap of about £200 to about 1850. That's very unwelcome for households and for the government. It takes prices back to where they were in about April 2025. But it's not a level which I would expect to trigger big temporary government intervention. It's below the level of the previous energy price cap, for example. And crucially, over the summer, the impact on households is not very significant. So because we don't use as much energy in the summer, it's an extra cost of just over £20 for the whole of July to September for typical households. So I would expect the Chancellor to be thinking mainly ahead to the winter and telling us about how she's thinking about designing support for the winter.
OK, so not to start the summer, to start in the winter would be your advice. And you say it's a political decision, but what would be your recommendation? If it's targeted, who should receive it? I mean, when there was that argument over winter fuel payments, there was talk about using council tax bands to decide who most needed support. That's far from perfect. What would be your recommendation?
So what we know is that the Chancellor has said she wants to target household income. Our recommendation would be to provide a targeted energy discount to lower income households. So a per unit discount on your energy. What that does is it allows you to target those families who are both low income, but to give more benefit to those with higher energy bills. What we don't know is what progress the government's been able to make on their practical ability to do that. The data wasn't available in 2022 to do that. And so have they been able to make that work, or have they done some other scheme? And just to illustrate the options here, if the government were to spend between 3.5 and 4 billion, I'd expect them to do something much smaller than that. But that's about the cost of kind of taking all remaining policy costs off bills. If they give that to everyone, it saves just over £100 per household. Whereas if they targeted that on, say, the 40% of lower income households, then those households will benefit from over £300.
So if I ask you how long this should go on for, that would be unfair in terms of geopolitics. We don't know how long energy prices might be remaining high, but how long could the government afford it? Because we know that the Treasury is under pressure already. We know that a result of the geopolitics and political turmoil here, we've got, you know, government borrowing figures going up. Rachel Reeves is also promising support for businesses. What is affordable?
Yeah, so I think it particularly matters whether these are temporary support or permanent actions to remove costs from energy bills. Those permanent actions would be welcome, but they would certainly need to be funded. When we look at the latest economic forecast for the impact of the war in Iran, for example, we think that will probably increase government borrowing by around £16 billion. So the Chancellor left herself enough wiggle room in her forecast to allow for a shock of that kind, but there's nothing much left for support like this. So it would need to be very temporary and very targeted to avoid pushing those borrowing costs that the UK faces up further, or she would need to find the money from savings or tax rises elsewhere. And I think we may hear more from the Chancellor about other things on cost of living next week. I don't know, but the other big impact is food prices. And we know that the Chancellor said previously she was looking, for example, at options to reduce imported tariffs on food and agriculture. So I'm sure that she is looking hard at options which don't cost the Treasury as well.
And what about businesses? Because, as I mentioned, the Chancellor has promised support. What could those measures look like?
So the Chancellor has extended the government's existing scheme for business support, known as the British Industrial Competitiveness Scheme. So that discounts energy bills for energy intensive manufacturers. It kicks in from April 27. That was only announced in April, so I don't know whether she will announce more for businesses next week, but it doesn't look straightforward to do that in a low-cost way.
Ruth Curtis, Chief Executive of the Resolution Foundation, thank you very much for your time.
3 minutes to eight is the time ahead of the Football World Cup. Radio 4 kicks off a new series this morning.
On BBC Radio 4,
Henry VIII had a pair of dedicated football boots. He played a version of folk football.
I'm David Padilla, and I'm asking how the history of the England football team can help make sense of what it means to be English.
There's a huge English exceptionalism in England's sort of punitive self-loathing. It's like we are the best at failing.
60 Years of Hurt on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
The triumph of old industrial working class England and its football cultures.
Starts this morning at 10. To listen on your smart speaker, just say play Radio 4.
It's 2 minutes to eight. Time for a look now at the weather. Elizabeth Rossini is at the BBC Weather Centre for us this morning. Good morning.
Hello, good morning. Yeah, plenty of weather to get through this weekend before temperatures start to lift and it'll feel a lot more like May again into next week. At the moment, of course, still rather chilly for the time of year. And we've seen a touch of frost this morning, particularly for Scotland, Northern England. But here, a lovely bright start to the day. There's been quite a lot of morning sunshine around. However, for Northern Ireland, Southwest England and Wales, turning a lot cloudier. There'll be outbreaks of rain here. There's a weather front gradually pushing eastwards as we head throughout the day. So even where it's been the chilly start to the day, I think we will be seeing the cloud through the afternoon, the sunshine lasting longest towards eastern areas. So that's across eastern Scotland and East Anglia. Still some brightness here into the afternoon. For western Scotland, Wales, northwest England, southwest England, then it will turn wetter as we head throughout the day. And that cloud is going to thicken up and then push further eastwards into central areas. For Northern Ireland, behind our weather front, then we're looking at sunshine and showers through the afternoon. Light to moderate westerly to southwesterly winds. With the change of wind direction, we'd expect the air to become a bit milder, but it's not going to feel dramatically milder today, I'm afraid. Still just 11 to 13 Celsius in the north, 13 to 15 degrees Celsius further south. Tonight, that cloud and rain still pushing eastwards. For Northern Ireland, scattered showers, some clear spells. For southeast England, we keep that thicker cloud until dawn. Elsewhere, clear spells and some showers developing. Gentle westerly winds. We're frost-free, 5 to 8 degrees Celsius tomorrow. Heavy thundery showers in the north and west.
Elizabeth, thank you for that. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Katja Adler and Justin Webb. It's 8 o'clock on Saturday, the 16th of May. The headlines this morning: tight security is in place for two rival protests, which the Metropolitan Police say will test London. We'll discuss how the police should approach today. President Trump has warned Taiwan against formally declaring independence from China after he visited Beijing for talks. And fans and contestants are preparing for the final of the Eurovision Song Contest, the world's biggest live televised music event.
Coming up this hour, after a bruising week, two veteran commentators tell us how the Prime Minister can wrestle back authority and the political agenda. The tallest and most powerful rocket in history is due to launch within days, if everything goes according to plan. And
everyone's collateral.
We hold the line. Where's your stomach?
I hope you all enjoy feeling your flesh sear in the hell you've created.
Why have recent hit TV dramas been so stressful? The co-creator of Industry, which you heard just there, tells us what the appeal of the tense workplace drama is.
Go head-to-head for the Scottish Premiership title, and will it be Chelsea or Manchester City who lift the FA Cup?
We'll never know what David Lloyd said, but here's the news with Vijay Alice.
Thousands of police will be on the streets of London today to manage two large protests in what the Met Commissioner has called one of the most significant policing operations in years. There will be what's called a sterile zone managed by officers between one march organised by the far-right figure Tommy Robinson and a pro-Palestinian demonstration. Facial recognition technology will be deployed, and prosecutors have urged police to intervene if chanting or slogans breach the law. In addition, tens of thousands of football fans are expected at Wembley Stadium for the FA Cup final. Tom Simons reports.
Tommy Robinson has called for a demonstration to unite the kingdom. Last year, around 150,000 turned out to a similar event. The Palestine Solidarity Campaign will commemorate the dispossession of Palestinians in 1948 and oppose Robinson's march. Police will use a facial recognition unit to spot suspects, and drones, helicopters and temporary lamppost-mounted cameras to monitor the crowds. 11 prominent far-right speakers have been banned from entering Britain. Police will also be watching and listening closely to the Palestine Solidarity protest. Prosecutors have advised police to step in and deal with chants and slogans which may breach hate crime laws.
Lord Mann, the government's independent advisor on anti-Semitism, told this programme that those arranging public events should screen their contributors to judge the level of risk their words may pose.
The police have a difficult job in handling protests, and the organisers of the demonstration should ensure that the people that they platform, give a microphone to, in front of how many thousands of people, have a responsibility to ensure that their speakers stay within the law, and that's whether it's a far-right demonstration, this demonstration, or any other demonstration.
Labour has begun the process of choosing a candidate for the Makerfield by-election, which may decide Sir Keir Starmer's future. Andy Burnham, the Mayor of Greater Manchester, has been cleared to put his name forward by the party's ruling National Executive Committee. He is likely to challenge the Prime Minister's leadership if he wins the seat. Mr. Burnham's supporters in Labour argue that he has the ability to communicate effectively with voters, while some of his opponents have accused him of behaving in an entitled manner. Our political correspondent Damian Grammaticus reports.
Midday on Monday is the deadline for potential Labour candidates for the Makerfield by-election to come forward. If there are others alongside Andy Burnham, Labour will decide a shortlist, hold hustings and make a final choice on Thursday. The by-election itself could be in 5 weeks' time. At that point, a challenge could come to Sir Keir Starmer's leadership, whether from Andy Burnham or another contender. But winning the by-election will not be straightforward for Mr. Burnham. Reform picked up 50% of the votes in the area in the recent local elections. It will select a candidate this week, and the Greens said they will enter the contest too. The Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson told Radio 4's The Week in Westminster she would back Mr. Burnham's campaign in Makerfield, even though he may immediately seek to oust the Prime Minister.
President Trump has warned Taiwan against formally declaring independence, saying he talked for a whole night about the issue with China's President Xi during his visit. Asked by Fox News whether the people of Taiwan should feel more or less secure after his visit to Beijing, Mr. Trump replied neutral. Officials in Taiwan, which is claimed by China, said they were thankful for the president's long-standing support. Our correspondent Joel Gunter was watching the interview.
Washington has traditionally maintained a policy of so-called strategic ambiguity towards Taiwan, sticking to a script of no comment on whether it would defend the self-governing island militarily. President Trump, not someone known to stick to the script, told Fox News last night that he was not looking to travel 9,500 miles for a fight with China over the island. China's President Xi will be happy to hear that and pleased, for now, that Mr. Trump is still withholding a planned $14 billion arms sale to Taiwan. Mr. Trump's remarks don't spell a significant shift for U.S. policy, however. The official position on Taiwan, according to Secretary of State Marco Rubio, remains unchanged.
Lebanon's health ministry says an Israeli airstrike on a civil defense center in the south of the country has killed 6 people, including 3 paramedics. Last night, the U.S. State Department announced that the ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon had been extended for another 45 days. From Jerusalem, Emir Nader reports.
On paper, a renewed ceasefire is in place, but any hopes that this new phase will be a true halt to the violence already appear to be in question. The killing of 3 rescue workers adds to the more than 100 paramedics killed by Israeli airstrikes since the latest round of fighting broke out in March. Hundreds in Lebanon and 6 Israeli troops have been killed since the ceasefire came into effect a month ago. The State Department said the ceasefire extension agreed yesterday would enable further progress, while Lebanese officials say it's a step towards a real end to the fighting. The thorny issues of Hezbollah disarmament and Israeli withdrawal from southern Lebanon are still to be negotiated in further US brokered talks in the weeks ahead.
Emergency services in Australia say a man in his 30s has been killed by a great white shark. The attack occurred off the coast of Perth. In January, a 12-year-old boy died after being attacked by a shark in Sydney Harbour. The Scottish FA has warned against intolerance and hysteria as the Premiership season builds to a dramatic climax with Hearts facing Celtic for the title. A 19-year-old man has been charged with a data protection offence after personal details of the referee who awarded a controversial penalty to Celtic on Wednesday were leaked online. The SFA said vigilantism was a scourge on the game. Our correspondent Lorna Gordon reports.
Hearts and Celtic are separated by just a point at the top of the Scottish Premiership. If the Edinburgh side clinch the title, it will be the first time in 66 years. The decider has gripped the country, but tensions have been running high. The referee who awarded Celtic a controversial late penalty on Wednesday and his family have been under police protection. The Scottish Football Association is urging tolerance and perspective. There are concerns also about the safety of fans. Police Scotland has criticised Celtic's lack of planning for an official title party should they win. That description of the club's behaviour is disputed by Glasgow City Council.
New research suggests millions of adults across the UK may not have told their families what they want to happen to their money and property when they die. A survey by the Society of Trust and Estate Practitioners, or STEP, found 8 out of 10 adults kept their loved ones in the dark and a third of people didn't have a will. Dan Whitworth from Radio 4's Moneybox has more details.
STEP questioned 2,000 adults for its survey and also heard from more than 500 of its members. Nearly half of them said they'd seen an increase in disputes after death from blended families, when people have second or third marriages and stepchildren are involved. Not leaving clearly laid out plans can cause serious financial problems in moments of already great distress, giving rise to arguments about things such as homes, pensions and savings. The advice is have open and honest conversations with loved ones, write down your wishes, and it can help, especially if your estate is complicated, to get legal advice.
The Eurovision final takes place tonight in Vienna as the Song Contest celebrates its 70th anniversary. 25 countries are taking part, including the UK, but Israel's participation has drawn protests, with several nations boycotting this year's event. Our correspondent Nomia Iqbal sent this report from Vienna.
For a song contest that says it's not political, Eurovision is finding it hard to back that up. Israel's presence has prompted a boycott by countries including Spain, one of its main financial backers. Ireland won't be there and is not broadcasting the contest. It is showing Father Ted reruns instead. The countries boycotting are angry about the number of Palestinians killed in the Gaza war. Russia was banned in 2022 over its invasion of Ukraine, but Eurovision said that was because its state broadcaster was deemed a propaganda arm of the Kremlin. Boycotting nations say the same logic should apply to Israel. Eurovision argues Israel's broadcaster, Khan, remains independent.
Nomi Iqbal reporting.
8:10 is the time. If you ask most British people whether they're in favour of freedom of speech, most would say yes. But in all circumstances, well, most would probably say no. There are some limits. So what are the limits? They will be tested again today in difficult circumstances for the police as pro-Palestinian demonstrators take to the streets. But another demonstration is also taking place from a group organised by the far-right activist Tommy Robinson. Several right-wing supporters from abroad have been banned from coming to Britain for that rally. The argument is not only about what is said, it's also about the routes that are being marched, and they're also highly contested. Let us talk first to Nick Aldworth, who's a former detective chief superintendent in the Met, former UK counter-terrorism national coordinator as well. Mr. Aldworth, good morning to you.
Good morning.
What do you make about the suggestion from those who are taking part, particularly in the pro-Palestinian march, that the police are overstepping the mark, that they are planning to do things to police today in a way that they shouldn't be?
Well, I think if those people who are making that sort of comment haven't read the mood music about communities and society being a bit fed up with not just their protests, but a range of protests being used to project hateful thinking and activity towards communities across London and the UK, then they're really missing the point. And I think that is all that the police are seeking to do today, is to ensure that legitimate, free protests can continue, but without the adverse impacts that they are starting to have on communities.
What Sir Mark Rowley says in the Times today is, we have taken a tougher and clearer stance on anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim chanting and hate crime overall. In other words, he is accepting that there is a different way of policing today, on both sides, actually, than there has been in the past.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Sir Mark and the Met Police generally are in an invidious situation around this, in as much as they're being asked to interpret the meaning of things that people are doing on protests, which aren't necessarily clearly defined by statute. And it feels to me like Sir Mark is being bold in what he's doing. He's obviously consulted with the Crown Prosecution Service to ensure that, you know, there is at least that support there should police start acting and enforcing the laws that exist, which do exist very clearly to tackle hate crime. But the definition of a hateful word or a saying or a slogan or a sign quite often is determined by precedent rather than being clearly defined in the law.
What about the idea, which seems to be the case for today, that if someone says something that the police decide is illegal from a platform, that potentially not only that they could be prosecuted, but actually that the organisers of the march could be prosecuted, even when it's something that they don't approve of, didn't approve?
Yeah, so I think the interesting thing is, you know, the ability to apply restrictions and conditions on marches and protests, meetings, has existed since 1986 and is used very, very regularly. And the organisers are responsible for the application of those conditions. I think what we're seeing today is a relatively new application of that piece of legislation. I think it very clearly will come with some challenges. But I think what it's being applied to do is to prevent the organised and structured use of platforms to project hateful thoughts, words and signs. I think it will always be impossible for the police and the Crown Prosecution subsequently to deal with people who spontaneously say something.
Right, so in those cases, yeah, you think that the organisers will not be responsible if they can say, look, I didn't know this was going to happen?
I think the police will seek to enforce it. I think proving that later in court will prove to be difficult.
OK, Nick Aldworth, thank you very much for that. We did invite the organisers of the Unite the Kingdom march, that's the one organised by the far-right activist Tommy Robinson, to come on the programme this morning. They didn't respond. But John Rees is here, co-founder of the Stop the War Coalition, which is one of the organisers of today's pro-Palestinian march. Good morning to you.
Morning.
What do you make of what you've just heard? To what extent are you worried that the police, in your view, will overstep the mark today?
I think that's a very considerable danger, and I would say that the whole run-up to this has been very badly mishandled by the police. You see, the annual NACBA march is a landmark march every year. Nobody's surprised that it's going to happen. Nobody's surprised about the date it's going to happen. We applied to the police for a route to march back in December. We didn't hear from the police again until March, when they told us they'd granted the entire central London government area to Tommy Robinson. Now, we wouldn't be in the place we're in this morning if the police had acted differently, if they'd got back to us, if they'd talked to us. And I would say in general, well, it's not surprising to me that the Metropolitan Police has the lowest confidence of Londoners at the moment.
Just
ever.
On that, though, they say they were already in discussions with the other protest group, with the Unite the Kingdom group. They've been actually having those discussions since last October. And you don't have a simple right to be somewhere in London. They have to organise the two marches together.
Well, in which case they should have told us, and we should have come to an accommodation much earlier than this. But I think what they should have said to Tommy Robinson is, you are deliberately and provocatively choosing the NACBA day to try and march in London and to try and take over the entire government area of London, and that is unacceptable. That should have been the police reply if they were indeed in touch with Tommy Robinson, and they should have said so.
Let's turn to this business of whether you, as organisers, could be held responsible for things that are said. What we're hearing there from Nick Aldworth is actually it was unlikely that that would happen. Does that satisfy you?
No, I think his word was that Sir Mark Rowley is being bold. I would say that Sir Mark Rowley is being reckless with free speech. It's an amazing thought to be organising a demonstration. I've been organising demonstrations since the Iraq War demonstrations, at least. An amazing thought that in the middle of a speech, a policeman will turn up on stage and arrest the speaker for saying something. Everybody in this country who's concerned about civil liberties, and many organisations that are, Amnesty and Human Rights Watch, think that we're going to a very, very dark place when that happens. You know, I was brought up on the history of the German socialist movement when a policeman had to sit on the stage when socialists were speaking. We're heading towards that world.
Well, except that some of the language that is used is plainly hugely offensive to a minority in this country, to Jewish people in this country, and is aimed at them, and, so the thinking goes, encourages violence against them. And in those terms, as I was saying in the introduction, people don't think we have a right, a total right to free speech, do they, or should they?
But none of this applies to us. We have organised 34 national demonstrations.
At which there some people have chanted globalise the Intifada.
Just let me finish. Nobody from the stage has chanted that. That has never been an official slogan, not on the front banner, not behind the stage.
Do you want people not to chant?
No, I don't, because I don't actually think that it's offensive. I think that the dictionary definition of that term, that it's an uprising.
Yes, but the historical reference. The point Mark Rowley makes is that it's the context.
Well, that's a very fine judgment for a policeman to be making. It's a very fine judgment. Actually, I find it difficult, I'll be honest with you. I've been an anti-racist all my life, and I find it difficult to be lectured by a police force which has been found institutionally racist on 8 occasions since the original McPherson report, the latest of which was the Casey report in 2023. I don't think that that policeman should be arbitrating what is and isn't racist, especially when he's addressing people whose whole campaigning life, and I'm not just talking about me, I'm talking about many, many thousands of people on that demonstration.
He says he's just enforcing the law.
He's not.
It's not what he wants.
No.
The law.
Well, here's an example of where he isn't just enforcing the law. The Metropolitan Police actually decided last January that globalise the Intifada was an arrestable phrase. So something that you could chant the day before completely legally was decided by a policeman, not by a law, not by a judgment in Parliament, not even by a Secretary of State, was decided the very next day to be illegal. That's the bad place to be.
John Rees, we've got to leave it there. I should say we did also ask the Metropolitan Police to come on, but they declined today.
It's 19 minutes past eight, and have a listen to this.
£25?
No, I ordered 200.
Where is beef?
You still got that meat connect? Get $12.50 for that on eBay.
Boom.
Who left this mess?
Nothing like a little challenge every now and then.
We've got some new faces with us today. Hi, come on over.
I'm so happy to be here.
Talk to me at the end of the day.
My
everyone's collateral.
We hold the line. Where's your stomach?
I hope you all enjoy feeling your flesh sear in the hell you've created.
Wow. That's a taste of some of the most talked about TV series of the moment, The Bear, The Pit and Industry. And what you may have gathered from that snapshot, or if you're a fan of those shows, you know they are less about distracting ourselves from the challenging times we live in and more about pressure, burnout and daily stresses of work. So why are we seemingly avoiding escapist entertainment for shows that plunge us into a high-pressure workplace? Well, I'm hoping to find out from Leila Latif, film and TV critic, and also Conrad Kay, TV writer and co-creator of Industry. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Hello.
Conrad, starting with you, why do we enjoy watching high-stress TV? And if I can ask you a personal question, I mean, you write the scripts, but do you watch it? Is that what you escape into at the end of a day?
Yeah, I mean, everything you're talking about is not just high-stakes TV, but it's workplace drama, right? And I think there's a short answer to that and a long answer. I think short answer is workplace dramas are very legible very quickly because the dramatic stakes are very legible very quickly. Works very fast to reveal character. And I think, well, you know, not everyone's lived through a zombie apocalypse or deactivated a nuclear device, but most people know what it's like to dread work on a Monday or to fancy a coworker or to even to come and to work hungover on a Friday. So I think there's a kind of simple feeling of like, there's a feeling of being able to empathize with the characters very deeply and be shown a world that might be more glamorous than your actual life, but one that you can project yourself into. But I think actually there's a larger thing going on with all these shows, which is, you know, I think it's very weirdly psychologically calming and satisfying to watch competent people be competent on screen. You know, the world is full of obstacles, dilemmas, anxieties, but you're kind of watching a kind of controlled chaos. And in TV, you know, you're going to get a resolution there, which is, I think, not what we can actively say about our day-to-day lives.
Okay. Leila Latif, what do you think? Do you think there's an element also that if you have a bad day at work and then you watch a drama about someone who's having a worse day at work, you can think, oh, at least, you know, my life isn't as bad as that?
Oh, yes, definitely. I think it's also one of the reasons that people often take strange comfort in horror films, where it's just like, well, things could be going worse. But yeah, these jobs as, you know, be a physician or working in finance or being a chef, not only are they stressful in the way that so many jobs are, they're also very unpredictable and very fast paced, and seismic things can happen so many times a day. So that just keeps you gripped as well. And, you know, there are also jobs where I think generally the public have got a vague understanding of how they work, but don't understand the intricacies. So we're kind of coming with a bit of an understanding, but also learning a huge amount as well, and often leave very grateful that these aren't the fields that we work in.
And Conrad, what techniques do you use to create the tension when writing? Because a lot of these series, it's tension upon tension upon tension. So you must have to use multiple techniques.
Well, I mean, screenwriting 101 is a character wants something and you put an obstacle in their way and then they navigate that obstacle and they either win or lose. Our rule on Industry was to try and do that as many times per episode as we could per character. The Pit does that really beautifully as well. I'm always, my main jealousy about The Pit is that I'm never in that writer's room because I'd like to look at the wall and look at all the different colored index cards because I have no idea how they map out those because they, you know, they do 30 patients a day. They have 15 different characters with different story arcs. It's a really kind of, it's a sight to behold, and I'm kind of envious of it, to be honest.
And can I just ask you, is part of your job these days also just making sure that those who are watching stay off their phones and on the screen?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we talk about that in the industry writers' room all the time. The idea of passive watching makes us feel a little bit ill. There's that kind of very dirty word that we don't like to use at all. We never use it at HBO and on the BBC as content. I mean, the idea of taking someone's attention and not actually doing something with it doesn't really sit well with us. So we try and make sure that people want to put their phones away. And, you know, if you watch Industry or The Pit, if you second screen that stuff, you get lost very quickly. And I think that's for the best.
And Leila Latif, when you have a look, because, you know, you're broadly a film and TV critic, there are these high tension workplace dramas out there. There's also a lot of other stuff. Is it still a mix of tastes or do you feel that broadly we are moving in that kind of more realism direction?
I think it is still a mix of taste, because sadly we do have a lot of people who aren't willing to fully devote themselves to an episode of brilliant television. But that's why I think shows like The Pearson Industry and, as you mentioned, The Bear, feel so worthwhile when you watch them, because you actually have given yourself over, you have focused, you've gotten into a whole new world, and you kind of almost feel like you've learned something a lot of the time. And so, you know, being as gripping as they are, I think there is a shift into that, because people don't necessarily just want to experience pleasant background noise anymore. We could do that on our phones, and when we want to sit down for some like proper event television, we want to be fully immersed and fully gripped. So I think this is a very reassuring trend that there's a lot of life left in TV yet.
I think if you're going to ask for people's attention, you've got to do something with it. That's what we think about.
But that makes perfect sense. I have to say, W1A, Justin, that was having a go at our workplace, wasn't it? Sometimes if you leave a workplace, I think I like diving into different workplaces in my dramas. But thank you for sharing your thoughts with us, Conrad Kay and Leila Lateef, very much.
8:25. Time for the sport. Here's Della.
Morning again, Justin. It's a huge day in both Scottish and English football, as the Scottish Premiership title will be decided and the FA Cup final at Wembley. Hearts need at least a draw at Celtic to win their first domestic title since 1960 and break the Glasgow duopoly for the first time since 1985.
We have to go there with courage, we have to go there with belief and be bullish with our work. It'll be bedlam, it'll be an unbelievable atmosphere just because of what's at stake.
I think the players, they've shown enormous character here to keep fighting right to the very, very end. But listen, we're there. We have a fight in our hands, but we're going to try our utmost.
The Celtic boss Martin O'Neill there before that Hearts manager Derek McInnes. And Radio 5 Live, of course, and BBC Sounds has the final day of the Scottish Premiership covered from midday. Well, from 3 o'clock, Chelsea take on Manchester City in the FA Cup final at Wembley. Let's speak to the former Tottenham and England goalkeeper Paul Robinson, who's part of 5 Live's coverage from Wembley. Morning, Paul.
Good morning, Dallas.
We know City have lost the last two FA Cup finals. They're going for the domestic cup double. They're still in the Premier League title race. How does that affect today, Paul?
They're the strong favourites, Manchester City. I think when you look at the two seasons that both sides are having, Chelsea are falling away in the Premier League. Obviously, we know that they relieved their manager of his duties not so long ago. And if results go against them, actually, while they're playing this FA Cup weekend, they could finish 13th at the end of the weekend, Chelsea, in the Premier League. So Manchester City obviously chasing the title, but I think the silverware will be of utmost focus for Pep Guardiola this weekend.
It seems strange, doesn't it? Because the title race is still ongoing. In this, of course, the second consecutive year, which is part of a deal between the FA and Premier League to stage the cup final on the penultimate weekend of the Premier League season. How does that sit with you, though, Paul?
I kind of like it because, you know, players wait for the end of the season and then to have to hang on for the FA Cup final at the end. I mean, there's so much football on at the moment. We've got the Championship playoffs still to come as well, let's not forget. But I think it just sits nicely before the end of the calendar. I think it's a huge spectacle. I mean, I grew up watching the FA Cup as a child. I think there's a lot of people that think the FA Cup has lost its gloss over the years, if you like. But it's slowly coming back, and the FA Cup final is such a big day in the football calendar, and I think it's of utmost importance to bring it to the forefront.
You mentioned City are the outright favourites. What an opportunity for Chelsea, particularly their interim boss Callum McFarlane as well.
Well, it's an audition, isn't it? I mean, there's a lot of speculation about the Chelsea manager's job and who's to take over. There's going to be a lot of high-profile managers that are out of work in the summer, linked to all of these big jobs. But when you look at Michael Carrick and look what he's done at Manchester United, and you see Callum McFarlane at Chelsea, he's got a real chance to put his name in the hat, if you like. And I think he's done an excellent job the times that he has taken over. But it's a huge football club, and it needs some direction at the moment. They're having a really poor season in the league, and an FA Cup final win would be huge for them and him as well.
The FA Cup, of course, follows what has been an interesting and fascinating title race in Scotland. Can I just quickly ask you, in terms of the Scottish Premiership title, how significant will it be if Hearts were to win today?
Do you know what, Darth? I've really enjoyed watching the league in Scotland this season. For once, the Hearts have joined the party. Celtic and Rangers have dominated that league for so many years, but there really has been a three-horse title race. Celtic with Martin O'Neill have been absolutely fantastic. I think they're 7 unbeaten now, or 7 wins in a row. Rangers have just fallen away at the end. But for Hearts to break the monotony, whether it's not Celtic or Rangers, for somebody else to win that league, And regardless of the quality or what you think of the league, I think it's been a really interesting watch, and it's been a brilliant title race this season. And I, as a complete neutral, would love to see Hearts win the league.
Absolutely. Paul, great to chat to you as ever this morning. Enjoy the FA Cup final later. The former Tottenham and England goalkeeper Paul Robinson there, part of Five Lives coverage, a commentary of both the FA Cup final, which kicks off at 3 o'clock, and Celtic Hearts from midday today across Five Live and BBC Sounds.
Thank you, Deleth. It's 8:30. Saturday Live this morning, and Adrian Childs can tell us a lot more.
Hello, good morning to you. Yes, we've got three great guests as usual. We've got JJ Chalmers, fascinating man, a Royal Marine veteran, sustained ghastly injuries in Afghanistan, has managed to rebuild his life. He's TV presenter now, working on the Chelsea Flower Show this week. Or he just confessed he's struggling to keep his own basil plant alive at the moment. Perhaps we'll have some advice for him. We've also got a legend of the food world, Ruth Rogers, with us, and a couple of podcasting dads who've got men talking about fatherhood by a simple means of offering classes in teaching them how to deal with their daughter's hair. Low ponies, high ponies, all sorts of complicated plaits. Brilliant idea. Also, we've managed to locate somebody who a woman called Angela wanted to thank for changing her wheel on the Winchester bypass. We found this knight in shining armour. We're going to bring them together. It is going to be emotional. And we have the inheritance tracks of Jason Watkins.
How can anyone else ever win an award? Adrian, thank you for that. You are listening to Today on Radio 4. Katya Adler, Justin Webb. It is 29 minutes to 9 and Vigi Alice has the news.
The Metropolitan Police Commissioner has said officers will be involved in one of the most significant operations in years today, with two major protests taking place. One has been organised by the far-right figure Tommy Robinson and another by pro-Palestine groups. John Rees, a co-founder of Stop the War, one of the organisers of that march, told us that Sir Mark Rowley was being reckless with free speech by saying officers would arrest people for chanting banned phrases. Labour has begun the process of choosing its candidate for the Makerfield by-election. A mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, has been given permission by the party to put his name forward. If he wins, he's likely to challenge Sir Keir Starmer's leadership. President Trump has warned Taiwan against formally declaring independence. He says he spoke to China's President Xi for a whole night about the issue. China claims Taiwan as part of its territory. And the US says a ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon has been extended for another 45 days. The Lebanese health ministry says an Israeli strike on the south of the country has killed 6 people. Israel and Hezbollah have been attacking each other during the ceasefire, as the Iranian-backed group is not a signatory.
Thanks, Vigi. It is 28 minutes to 9. Let's turn now to the Middle East. Israel says it carried out strikes over the Gaza Strip, though the BBC can't yet verify the Israeli government's claim that it killed the Hamas commander Izzaz Din al-Haddad in those strikes, one of the architects of the October 7th attacks. Now, in theory, there is a ceasefire currently in place over Gaza as part of US President Donald Trump's peace plan. Earlier this week, Nikolai Mladenov, the high representative for Gaza to the US-led Border Peace, spoke to journalists in Jerusalem, and this was his assessment of the state of the ceasefire.
We have a ceasefire. It is holding. It is not perfect. It is far from perfect. There are violations every day, and some of them are very serious. And let's be honest about these violations and what they mean in practice. They mean that civilians still are being killed, that families live in fear, that delays and restrictions continue to affect humanitarian access and daily life. For many Palestinians in Gaza, in fact for all Palestinians in Gaza, the war does not yet feel fully over, and I think this is the reality that we all in the Board of Peace and our partners recognize fully.
That was Nikolai Mladenov from the US-led Board of Peace. It's their high representative from Gaza. Well, the Peace Board pledged to organise the reconstruction of Gaza. According to the UN, 90% of Gaza's homes, 70 to 80% of schools and hospitals and infrastructure were destroyed during the Gaza war that followed the October 7th attacks. All of that produced 60 to 70 million tonnes of rubble, which we're told could take 7 years to clear. Well, Patrick Griffiths is ICRC spokesperson in Jerusalem, who was just in Gaza a few days ago. Good morning to you.
Morning.
Now, you international journalists aren't allowed into the Gaza Strip unless it's under Israeli military supervision. We do have pictures, of course, all over social media of devastation. What were your impressions? Take us there with you.
Yeah, I mean, the images don't prepare you for what it feels like to see it all in person, right? So, I mean, I'm back in Jerusalem now, but there are three images that really stay with you. One is, so once you enter into, you know, through Kerem Shalom into Gaza, and you see stretching 4 kilometres, just mounds of rubble, so broken slabs of concrete, twisted rebar, not a building standing in sight. And then you cross into the area where people can live, are forced to live, and that image like of rubble is replaced with the image of a sea of tents, you know, crowded close to each other. And these are large Palestinian families forced to live in incredibly small spaces with no privacy. And then I was based in the center of Gaza, and we did a couple of trips up to Gaza City. And you see essentially the ghost of a city. You see hollowed out buildings. We visited our Shifa hospital, you know, this hospital, which looks like no hospital should, riddled with bullets, scarred, you know, with the scars of more than 2 years of conflict. Those images are haunting and they stay with you. And they also underscore that healthcare really is a casualty of this armed conflict, and that death and destruction for Palestinians in Gaza continues every day.
And as for ongoing violence, because there is, you know, in theory, a ceasefire in place, but we've heard about airstrikes overnight. Rockets are still being fired from the Gaza Strip into Israel. Mm. What do you feel of that when you are in the Gaza Strip?
You hear it. When I was staying at our Red Cross Field Hospital in southern Gaza, which is supported by the British Red Cross, by the way, but every day it's part of your daily routine. You hear the sounds of gunfire, you hear the sounds of explosions, you hear drones overhead all day, all night. When I mentioned I visited Al-Shifa, when I was there, a paramedic was brought in. Not a paramedic bringing in a patient, a paramedic was brought in who had been shot and hit by a stray bullet and killed. They had, you know, this is the way there. They had the body bag open on the ground so that family, friends and colleagues could say farewell to this paramedic who had been shot and killed. And that's not unusual. That is the norm. My colleagues at the Red Cross Field Hospital told me stories of how only a few weeks earlier there was a mass casualty event, you know, where multiple people were injured and killed all at once. And there was an influx of patients to the hospital. One of the surgeons I spoke to told me about trying to treat a young boy who had severe head trauma and being unable to save them, and how that experience stays with you for a long, long time. So although the ceasefire offers a glimpse of hope, and it does, unless it translates into positive improvements in terms of the conditions on the ground for Palestinians, I mean, that's what needs to happen.
And yeah. And just briefly, I mean, from the, we talked sanitation, obviously the population of Gaza, civilian population squeezed into a small area, Israeli military presence, very large on the ground. The aid trucks, I mean, before this latest bout of violence, there was 130 or more aid trucks going in to the Gaza Strip every day. They were supposed to be coming back in now with the ceasefire. Mm. How is it? Is enough? Is enough coming in?
I think the main issue here is that Palestinians in Gaza are entirely dependent on what is allowed in or not. Right. So, yes, since the ceasefire, you did see a slight improvement in the amount of food that came in. But then when there was the regional escalation of armed conflict, you know, the armed conflict with Iran, you saw restrictions come back in force, like more in place. And there was less food on the market. Prices skyrocketed again. And that kind of really paints a picture for how dependent Palestinians in Gaza are on what is allowed to be brought in or not. And what we know as the ICRC is that these restrictions, they canvas things from, you know, plaster of Paris powder, you know, which is used to make molds for prosthetic limbs so that those who have had amputations can learn to walk again. It covers seeds. It covers basic food items. More needs to be able to come into Gaza. And that's part of our ongoing dialogue with Israeli authorities. Yep.
Patrick Griffiths from the International Red Cross. Sorry to interrupt you then. Thank you very much for joining us. Also joining me, Jeremy Bowen, the BBC's chief international correspondent. Good morning.
Morning.
Now, the Donald Trump's Board of Peace, it had this 20-point Gaza reconstruction plan. We're supposed to be moving to the full demilitarization of Gaza, including the disarmament of Hamas. That's not what we're seeing.
Yeah, and including the withdrawal of Israeli troops, and we're not seeing any of those things. I spoke to a senior Palestinian official this morning who said the whole process is entirely frozen. This process, based on the 20-point peace plan, clearly isn't working. There have been talks. Hamas has engaged in some talks about handing over governmental responsibilities, limited disarmament, but the sides are way, way apart. And Hamas doesn't really show any sign of wanting to disarm. So that is considered to be the starting point of this entire process. So as you've been hearing, there is a continuing massive humanitarian crisis. And because people like me can't get in there, journalists can't get in there, foreign journalists can't get in there to report the story because Israel continues to impose restrictions. Sadly, with everything else going on in the Middle East, all this has fallen out of the headlines. But that does not mean that the plight of civilians in Gaza is any less than appalling. And it could be a lot better. But as you've been hearing, that's not happening.
You talk about everything else going on in the Middle East, obviously the crisis around Iran, but also the situation in Lebanon, which we've been hearing about this morning. More Israeli strikes overnight at the same time that Israel has agreed with the Lebanese government to extend a ceasefire by 45 days. It's a shaky one and described as in name only, isn't it?
Yeah, it is in name only. And actually, when you hear reports of, not reports, you hear confirmation of civil defense workers, paramedics, more than 200 children being killed by Israel inside Lebanon. And then you also hear talk about the ceasefire being extended. You'd be forgiven for thinking, well, what kind of Alice in Wonderland world are we living in here? The fact is, though, that the Iran-backed group Hezbollah are not a party to the ceasefire. Israel also has a big exemption in the terms of the ceasefire, which means that it can attack when it feels that it is potentially being threatened or actively being threatened. And so at a lower level, the war has continued there. And also this American involvement in the ceasefire process started because it was one of Iran's demands of the Americans in terms of having that wider ceasefire in the Gulf. Now that is looking increasingly strained, to put it mildly, and certainly speaking to, you know, senior Gulf Arab sources, there are fears that there could be a return to full-scale war as the economic consequences, particularly of the closure of the Gulf, continue to bite, not least in the United States. Mm. There will be a moment when Donald Trump will have to decide whether or not he wants to go back to war, and some very influential people inside Gulf Arab countries fear that moment could be approaching fast.
Well, Donald Trump's looking at opinion polls at home, and he's under a lot of pressure. The Iran war, very, very unpopular. But Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, under pressure too, upcoming elections in Israel. Is that affecting his attitude towards ceasefires in Gaza and Lebanon?
Benjamin Netanyahu's continuing hold on power and his political survival is essentially one of the wellsprings of the way that he sets policy for Israel. It's not the only one, but it's a very important thing for him to stay in power. He's accused of very serious corruption charges. He's been on trial, a very, very slow-speed trial for a long time. If he lost power, that trial would speed up, and there are plenty of people inside Israel who think he'll end up in jail if that trial went to fruition. Trump himself has said that the Israeli president should pardon him. So there are that domestic political imperative is a big part of Israeli policy, as well as the fact that there is a strong agreement inside Israel that the country is threatened and that the only way they can deal with it is by using military force. And that's something that that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu reinforces that message the whole time.
Jeremy Bowen, BBC International Editor, thank you.
It is 16 minutes to nine. Let us turn to the Labour leadership contest, which is, of course, not underway, but, well, underway at the same time. Andy Burnham, the Mayor of Greater Manchester, almost certain to contest the by-election in Makerfield on June the 18th. If he wins, then either to fight Keir Starmer for the crown or perhaps just be handed it. Let us talk to Alison Phillips, CEO of the think tank Think Labour and former editor of the Daily Mirror as well. And Baroness Cavendish is also on the line. Camilla Cavendish, non-affiliated peer, but former director of the Number 10 Policy Unit under David Cameron. Morning to you both.
Morning.
The first question, I suppose, arising from that business of whether he should just be handed it. If Alison Phillips, he wins, if Andy Burnham wins in Makerfield, what should happen then?
I think at that point that there should be a contest if the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, is still willing and wants to fight, as he has said he will do up until now, then I think there is the kind of a real need for a contest, because this isn't just about the individuals, it's about the ideas that they bring, and it's about the response to the local election results that we saw last weekend, which was so devastating. And I think what is required is a conversation about what, as a party, Labour does to try and come back from that when there's only sort of now nearly halfway through to the next election.
Camilla Cavendish, do you agree?
I do agree, but I think Labour needs to stop talking about party and start talking about country, because actually what really matters is the government of the whole country. And I totally understand that Labour's, you know, embroiled in a conversation with itself. But I think when Wes Streeting resigned and called for a contest of ideas, what he is talking about is what actually is going to work for Britain at this particular moment, because we're on the verge of a fiscal crisis. We can't afford to just retreat to the sort of comfort zone of the soft left and keep dodging difficult decisions. So a contest of ideas is great. let's have it. But let's hope that we don't end up with a government which just retreats to the same comfort zone it's in at the moment.
There is also an argument, isn't there, Alison Phillips, that actually if he wins Makerfield, he's beaten Reform. And beating Reform, never mind the future of the country, for the party, it really matters. So he is then in such a powerful position that the idea that you then hold a contest and say, maybe Andy Burnham, maybe not, is really for the birds.
Yeah, I mean, obviously this would be quite totemic. But what we have seen is that at the moment, in the last week's elections and more broadly, Labour has been losing to Reform, but also remember that some of those wins, they're not necessarily people going direct from Labour to Reform. Some of it is that the Conservative sort of collapse has meant that the Reform has consolidated that right bloc. And then, of course, Labour has also been losing voters on the left towards the Greens. And so the idea that there's a lurch to the left is going to be a solution to this, or a lurch to the right is a solution to this. There's no credibility in that. The only way that really that Labour come through to serve for the country, I completely take Camilla's point that this is about what's best for the country. It's not just about Labour, but going one way or the other is not the answer. It is about looking at what can be done to build a coalition that can serve the country better.
I mean, it's also, isn't it, about doing what Labour said they were going to do when they came to power in 2024, which is to be calm and sensible and stable and actually take politics out of most people's lives, Camilla Cavendish. Now, I wonder if that, in a sense, that quite apart from policies, whether you're left or right or whatever, that actually that will be the argument that once again wins it, or maybe we've had enough of stability.
Oh, no, no. I mean, you're quite right. And Starmer said he would tread more, you know, lightly on people's lives, which was a wonderful quote. But the reality is he's brought in, you know, the Employment Rights Act. We've got hospitality struggling to hire people. We've got, you know, employers freezing the hiring of young people with the rising national minimum wage. I mean, the answer to all of this is to improve Britain's productivity and economic growth. And we need to unleash the entrepreneurialism and animal spirits in this country. And unfortunately, the tone of this government, which never talks about business or talks about growth but doesn't deliver it, I think is problematic. So I think, you know, more optimism would be great, but also just put the money behind it. So whether that's actually delivering the defence investment plan, whether it's actually deregulating construction industry so we can build the houses, you know, we need to deregulate. And all we've seen is increasing incremental regulation.
Do you think, I'll come to Alison Phillips on that in a second, but do you, Camilla Cavendish, do you think Andy Burnham might do that? Because it's not, I mean, he's not got a firm set of national principles that he has yet adopted, has he? I'm putting this cautiously.
Exactly. Well,
but on the other hand, yes, he does have a track record in Greater Manchester.
So this is one of the fascinating things about Andy, is that no one can quite pin him down, which could be a huge advantage because I think he's quite a flexible politician. On the other hand, he has the backing of the socialist group in the Labour Party, John McDonnell and so on. I think it's why the contest of ideas that Wes Streeting is calling for is really important in the next few weeks. If Burnham wins Macfield, as Alison said, he shows he can see off Nigel Farage, and that is really important for the Labour Party, and I would assume they will all unite around him. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be pushing him to state some of his views. I think it is very, very hard to pin him down.
Anson Phillips, do you think he will be pinned down, and will he have to be before the by-election, or will he simply wait, go through the by-election, fight it locally, as he's every right to do, and then we discover?
Well, he's spoken a lot, and there's been a lot of talk around Manchesterism, which is the idea, I think, of a sort of a more active state. And there's the big example that is given frequently is about what he did with the buses there, and where the private network was failing. He's come in, and sort of the public involvement there has completely transformed that. So I think, whilst I think he would say he's very much, and he's worked very collaboratively with business, and that's how he would sort of see it on the national scale, he believes that the state must play a part when the private sector is letting people down. So I think there is a message there that could translate.
What about the animal spirits, though, that Camilla Cavendish referred to? I mean, does he have, in other words, a sort of sympathy for the private sector and an understanding that the private sector is eventually what drives us out of the despair that we're in now?
Well, I think the evidence from Manchester is absolutely that he does, because I think Manchester's, you know, according to some figures, growing at twice the rate of elsewhere in the country, and that if that could be replicated, and that sort of those relationships with private investment, that could get us to the point of the growth that is necessary, because without that growth, people can talk about cost of living till the cows come home, but it's only really that growth that is going to affect people's pockets.
Do you think, Camilla Cavendish, that argument about the extent to which, I mean, it comes down to really kind of obvious fiscal realities, doesn't it? But also the argument that you've just made about animal spirits, etc., that is an argument that can be convincingly won in a way that those who are on the losing side, and I'm thinking of what's happened to Keir Starmer in the years since the election, those who are on the losing side within Labour accept, OK, we've lost, now we're all going to stick together.
Well, Alison would know this better than me. I'm not sure. I mean, it does seem to me that what we've seen in the last 2 years is a government which was elected on a manifesto which included curbing welfare, which with a parliamentary party that simply refused to pass even the most basic welfare reforms. And the Tony Blair Institute last week put out a really interesting proposal, what they called an emergency brake on the growth in benefits, because we've got about 1,000 new people a day going on to benefits. And there's quite a lot of, you know, you can define non-work limiting conditions, for example. I mean, we're just pushing people onto the scrap heap every day. The Institute was suggesting you could do a few things through secondary legislation, i.e. you can get round your own parliamentary party. But again, that's where Starmer hasn't been very smart. He's completely been hamstrung by his own parliamentary party in doing some of those fairly moderate, pragmatic things.
Do you think, Alison Phillips, then, that the party, the backbenchers, would still be as difficult as they've been to a leadership, given that there is just a split, isn't there? Or are there several splits, actually, within the wider Labour family? What is the chances that a government can pull together and have full support of its backbenchers under whoever the next Prime Minister is, assuming there is a new one?
So whether you use the word split or whether you use the word spectrum, there has always been, throughout history, sort of a wide spectrum of people within Labour. And essentially, that has to remain if Labour is to win.
But Tony Blair was able to do things. I suppose that's the point.
And
upset people within the party, but they staged them or didn't object too much.
Exactly. And so my point is exactly the same, that it is possible to hold that coalition together. But it's about sort of showing the vision, and that some people within that coalition might have to accept bits that they don't like. But if they can understand that the end goal is going to change the country for the better, I think they can be taken on that journey.
We haven't mentioned reform, but Camilla Cavendish, they need the right candidate, don't they, if they're going to have a hope in Makerfield?
Sorry, reform do?
Yes.
You mean?
Yeah. I mean, they could, yes, obviously, if you look at the polls, it's a seat that's winnable for them, potentially, although Andy Burnham is very popular, yep. But only yes. with the right candidate.
Well, I mean, I think the one of the many terrible things about this awful kind of stealth race contest of the next at least 6 weeks we're going to have to endure is that every single person in the Labour Party and every single person in Reform will be all over Makerfield. So if I was living there, I'd kind of shut my door and not answer the bell. But yes, they will have to have the right candidate. But don't forget also Labour's vulnerable to the Greens on its left. So it's very much, it's going to be a very knife-edge contest.
Camilla Cavendish, Alison Phillips as well. Thank you both.
It's 5 minutes to nine.
Now, we're going to turn to the Scottish Premiership title because it's going to be decided when Celtic and Hearts clash at Celtic Park this afternoon. Celtic have to win to lift their fifth straight league title. Hearts need to avoid defeat to secure the trophy. Graeme Sibley and Kyle Speakman are on the line. Graeme Sibley was at the final that Hearts played back in 1986. And Kyle Speakman is 23, but has lived in Australia for 20 years, just got on a plane, a few weeks ago to come and watch the rest of the season, though has yet to get a ticket to the final. Kyle, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Oh, dear. What are you going to do?
Oh, I'm just going to the fan zone in Edinburgh.
Will that still have been worth it?
Yeah, hopefully. If we win it, it will be.
And if you don't?
Oh, well. We'll see. We will.
Graeme, is that your attitude too?
No, I mean, I'm lucky enough to have a ticket for the game today. So, I'm very excited. And this could banish away the 86 disaster, last day loss of the season. So, yeah,
tell us what happened in 86.
Yeah, so we went on a very long unbeaten run. We weren't the favourites. And we came to the last day. We just needed a draw. And we lost 2-0. And we lost the title on goal difference. So it was hard, but at the time you thought, well, it's okay, it'll happen, you know, got another chance next year. But all the money came into Rangers at the time, and it's, you know, become a duopoly since, which is why this is so exciting this season.
Yeah,
that other teams can, you know, realise it can be done.
That's the point, isn't it? It is just Celtic Rangers and no one else, or has been for so long now. So it's not just that it matters to Hearts fans, which obviously it does. It matters to Scottish football.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, hopefully this will encourage other teams to look at the way they trade and not have the fear factor that everybody has had for 40 years. It's just hopefully you can open up our league to realise it's far more exciting than it has been, and we can sell that to the rest of the world, because there's been more interest this year because Hearts have challenged Rangers and Celtic than there has been in our league for years.
So, Kyle, do you agree with that? I mean, could this open up Scottish football to the rest of the world in a way that it isn't at the moment? You think of those two clubs, Celtic and Rangers, but you don't, I suppose, in the rest of the world, think about much else.
Yeah, absolutely. It would be massive for the league. Not only Hearts, just everyone involved in Scottish football.
Do you have a hope that even if it doesn't go the way you want it to go, that the very fact that Hearts are nearly there, Kyle, sort of opens up the possibility to people around the world?
Yeah, of course it will open up the possibilities, but if Hearts do go on and win it, it'll be even bigger.
Graeme Sibley, what about the idea? I'm sorry to get you both to contemplate this, but if it doesn't work out as you want it to work out, does it nonetheless work out potentially as something that brings Scottish football and just an interest in Scottish football to a wider public?
Yeah, I mean, I think with our new investment and our data analytics, then, you know, James Allen Analytics, it just means that this isn't a one-off. This is just the start of Tony Bloom's 10-year plan. So I'm fully confident that should we lose today, it's not the end, it's just the beginning.
And have you got a full team to put out?
We've got a number of injuries, but, you know, every club has to deal with injuries, and it won't be an excuse. That's why we have a squad, and we've got total faith and trust in our manager, the best manager we've had for 30 years. And we're there because of him, and the team shows a unity amongst each other as well as the supporters that I haven't seen for years.
And financially, because money matters in football, doesn't it? Financially, what would it mean for the club? So you've got players, decent players, and obviously a very good manager as well. What does it mean for the club to win?
Well, it gives us more exposure, so we can then sell all the players that we've developed for more money. Once we're in Europe, the value of players goes up. Nobody looks at